Maybe I'm out here, you thought I don't want to make a meeting.
Yeah, I do.
These are my headset was logging illegally, but it was
not to my knowledge. On the phone, we have.
We have potentially four people.
Who are all John Dwyer?
Who's on the phone, please?
Curtis.
Janice.
Hi, Janice.
What's up?
Hey, Tim.
Eric.
Hey, Eric.
Janice, Tim, and Eric.
Is that it? Debbie, you on?
I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
Debbie's here. On. Okay, thanks.
How are you, John?
Hi. How are you?
Your folder looks like mine.
Yeah.
I decided to clean the house a little bit yesterday. Because it was fun. I can bring this to them, and I kind of want to be thank you to the parents. This will help me out. The little tiny one, what do you know?
The 62nd meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingart. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Kurt Alstead, I'm a public member, reside in Chester Township.
Tracy Curlicchio, public representative, Hunterdon County.
Amy Letts, Precipity in Morris County. Felicia Wade, Fayette County Freeholder.
And on the phone, we have several people. On the phone?
Janice Kovacs, town of Clinton, Hunterdon County. Debbie Pasquale, Greenwich Township, Warren County.
Tim Dillingham, I'm a public member living in Mercer County.
Peterson, Hunterdon County Freeholder.
Okay. We have a quorum. This meeting has been advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act and is also publicized on the Highlands Council website. I'll just repeat that if we ever need to cancel a meeting or because of weather or anything else, that would be on the website as well, and you can find out the council phone number. All who wish, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
My allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
In our packets, we have the minutes from our last meeting, January 17th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
For a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Any comments or corrections to the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Any abstentions? Okay, the minutes are approved. For members of the public, the agenda for the meeting and some supporting materials are on the table in front as you came in. We mentioned a couple of things in my report. Scott Whitenack was planning to be here today and just wrote in this morning that his younger brother died unexpectedly last night. So we don't know more than that. So we will convey, I guess, we can convey information to all of us as we learn more. We concluded the public hearings. Today is the conclusion of public comment period, so people presumably will be submitting. I think we have comments from 150 or so people, and today we received 150 pages of comments from one group of commenters. But we will. We will presumably be receiving more written comments. As long as they're postmarked by today, they'll be welcomed. Three public hearings, pretty much everyone on the council would attend at least one of them, and been a number of press reports about them. The tape recordings of all three public hearings are on the council's website and are available both to council members and to the public, so anyone can listen to those. You may have noticed the governor made a budget address earlier in the week that has some implications for the Highlands Council, some of which are known and some of which aren't yet, because the details of the budget won't be available for a while, and then that's the governor's proposed budget, and obviously the legislature can change that in major or minor ways as over between now and June 30th. But the things we do know is the budget does include $12 million for the council for dedicated for grants, as it has in the past, and so that money is in the governor's proposed budget. We don't know what it says about the council's operating budget for next year, but those numbers haven't been released yet. We also do know, everybody knows, that the governor has proposed doing away with three state agencies, including the Department of Agriculture, which is obviously significant for would be significant for the council. There is a fair amount of immediate opposition to that, and it may well not happen, or it may, but in any case, I've asked Eileen to have the staff prepare for us an analysis of all the places in the Act where we have to have interaction with the Department of Agriculture as we move forward, both on plan adoption and plan implementation, and so that we can then present that to the council so we can get a sense of what, regardless of what any of us as individuals think about the proposal, what the interests of the Highlands Council are that need to be protected if that department's going to be done away with and its responsibilities in one way or another folded into other state agencies. That's obviously something we're going to have to pay attention to and follow as we go by, as time goes on. A couple of other things I wanted to mention before getting to Eileen's report. We received a letter from the Township of Bedminster expressing interest in participating in the conformance process. And hopefully we'll receive many more such letters, but this is a nice indication since we didn't solicit them yet and the mayor has written indicating an interest in participating in the conformance process and expressing an interest in applying for the for a grant under the program we are going to consider today. But just for frame of reference, Bedminster's a town with about 1,000 acres in the preservation area and more than close to 17,000 acres in the planning area. So it is essentially a planning area town that has is at this point interested in opting in to the plan. Finally, my report, the council, we are scheduled to meet a week from today at 4 o'clock, and so there are a number of items that are on the agenda that we'll consider at that time, including staff should by that point have some at least broad sense of what the range of the public comments we've received are, and we can talk about a schedule for moving ahead to make sure that we have time to consider all the issues that are raised by the public and the changes that the public comments suggest may be necessary in the plan before adoption. So I would ask next week that you make sure to bring your calendars, or we may do this by email in advance, but we would probably need to add some council meetings in the spring to make sure that we have time to do that. And I think we will move increasingly toward meeting as a committee of the whole as we did in the fall, so that any of the issues that any changes that are considered in the plan are considered by the full council. And, as we do that, there will also be issues next week. The Council on Affordable Housing's rules are out, draft rules are out for public comment, and we'll be considering, the staff is preparing comments on those rules from the council, and we'll be reviewing that those draft comments from the council and considering that next week. And council members, we should all receive a draft of those in advance of the meeting and have a chance to see that.
Good morning.
Jack Schreier has arrived, and there are four members of the council on the phone. We'll also be considering redevelopment procedures, and we probably need to move ahead on considering two wastewater quality plan amendments, one that the Natural Resources Committee has discussed previously but has not yet reached a resolution on, is the one for the for Trump, where the last thing in the Natural Resources Committee committee came up with information that the staff needed to collect, which is now public. And the other is a public health and safety waiver submitted by Mount Arlington that we will also try and consider next week. So that concludes my comments, my report. Are other council members have items they wish to report at this time?
I'd like to just note, Mr. Chairman, that I brought with me today about 25 or 30 public comments that I received in my freeholder office. This represents about 50% of the comments that were received, including a great number of emails from people who are commenting on the plan, and I believe that all of these have also been shared or directed to the staff as well. Clearly, this is no less an issue now than it was when it was when the Act was introduced in 2004 and adopted. And some of these comments, as I read through them, are quite substantive. Others are very frivolous, it seems to me, and very superficial. They are repetitive. They are from people who clearly, on investigation, haven't got a really deep understanding of what it is that they're commenting on, which is not to say that the comments are not valid, but they don't carry as much weight, at least with me. So I just pass that on. People are certainly free to express their opinions. That's what the public comment period is for. But I think that it does a disservice to the staff and to the work that the council has done, and particularly the executive director, to malign her personally in some of these comments for the work that she's been doing. And I want to put that on the record.
Okay. John, I've got something. Obviously, the proposal to eliminate the Department of Ag is something that's pretty close to home for me as a council member that's a full-time farmer and resides in the preservation area. And I certainly did already have a conversation with Eileen to start the research, because I think that there is a significant impact in not only the act itself, the Highlands Act, but also our master plan if we lose the Department of Agriculture. And interestingly, I did a little research, and in the Highlands Act, agriculture is mentioned 33 times as an industry, and the Department of Agriculture is referenced 10 times. And in our draft plan, the agriculture as an industry is mentioned 179 times, and the Department of Agriculture is specifically referenced 31 times. So clearly the role of the department in this process is large. The legislators purposely put a parallel track for agriculture separate from other industries in the Act because they saw that there were special needs. And I can tell you, as a full-time farm family that's made a long-term commitment to remain in this state, preserve the farm, and have literally invested millions of dollars in improvements and capital improvements, expecting us to farm without a department would be the equivalent of Pharaoh in Egypt telling the Jewish slaves to make bricks without straw. It just won't work. And I can't simply tell you a specific thing that the department does that makes a big difference, but I can tell you that the cumulative effects of the department as an advocacy department for the industry is huge. And to lose that advocacy role that the department provides our industry would really be devastating, especially when you consider the billions of dollars that have been invested into farmland preservation by both the state, the counties, and the municipalities. So it's a passionate issue for me, and I hope that the council will take some action on this once we've completed our research. And in order for you to assist you with this research, I brought a few things today. I brought the resolution from the State Agricultural Convention. In New Jersey, very unique in that the farmers themselves actually direct the policies of the Department of Agriculture and actually even select the secretary. So just recently, at the beginning of this month, the annual agricultural convention was held, and this is the new policy on the Highlands from the delegates at the Agricultural Convention. So I'll pass these around, and I brought some extras for the audience as well so you can see what the delegates concluded. And then I also brought some bullet points for why we might consider the Agriculture Department to be a department worth keeping. And I want to be very mindful, as a conservative Republican, I'm in no means opposed to government spending, but I think it's important that we look at it very pragmatically and offer cuts across the board and perhaps not just target a single department. And I also even brought a sample resolution. I know that I've had conversations with Mayor Cogger, who's one of our council members, and I know that Chester Township's going to be authorizing a resolution of similar language, and I'm sure many freeholder boards have already offered language and supporting the restoration of funding for the department. So again, I appreciate your inputs, and I did bring extras of these again for the audience. And this, I think, is a very important and defining moment for the state and its policies toward agriculture, because I think the dissolution of the department really goes a long way to saying, even though you're 20% of the state's land base, we really don't hold you as, or value you as being something important as an industry anymore. So I appreciate your consideration as we do our research. And of course, Eileen, I'm ready to work.
Thank you.
For free. Or I should say for triple time.
Right.
Which is still free. Right.
Other comments for council members? Executive Director's Report.
Good morning, all, and thank you. I did send to all council members an executive director's report, and did some of the items have been covered already by the chair. But just to talk about, in general, the public comment period, as the chair informed everybody, does close today, though we do accept comments that are date marked today, and those emails that will, I presume, arrive into the office before dawn of tomorrow. So today, this week, of course, was our busiest week for receipt of those comments, and as the chair pointed out, some voluminous comments were received last night and this morning. So to date, the staff doesn't know the full enormity of those comments and hasn't had a chance to categorise them to facilitate the work of the council in considering them. What we did for the 2006 comments was categorize them so that we could see where there were comments in common under different categories, so that the council could then focus in on those categories and the different comments, because sometimes the comments are actually in contradiction one to the other. We will do that same process. We're going to try to proceed as quickly as we can. I don't want to give you a date by which we'll give you those categorised comments because of not being positive what will come in the next few days. But to tell you, the staff have a database set up and have already begun that process and already have, we did the transcription, or it wasn't quite transcription, but the minute taking of those public hearings. We had professional staff attending those meetings. And administrative staff as well that took notes at those meetings so that we would have a full recording as well as the audio recording. We will, of course, have a public comment response document prepared as well. I did want to outline some of the projects being worked on, most of which relate to public comments, and this has been work that has been ongoing over the past month. We're looking again at the cluster development goals, policies and objectives in the plan, and in already knowing some of the comments that we've received and some of the comments we've received from our council members, are looking at the cluster to address concerns raised regarding potential for clusters on septic systems in agricultural areas. The concern was that there'd be increased pollutant loadings beyond what is considered acceptable. So we will have more work done for you on that, in that area. Also, there was concern about sort of the leapfrogging effect of clusters, and what the plan really calls for is municipal planning through conformance that would look at where those clusters would be placed in an effort to make sure that they were in fact clustered together. So we will bring back more work to you in that area. The confidential lists of priority parcels for agricultural and open space preservation resource protection. This is mandated in the Act, and I know council members and members of the public have asked, have we done that work? We have done the draft of that. We're still working on it in-house. And it will be ready and will be transmitted when this council decides on adoption of a regional master plan. What I wanted to ask for your direction and agreement on is the expectation that this, as mandated in the Act, is a confidential list available only to key staff and sent to just to Greenacres and SADC, as again mandated by the Act. The methodology, of course, will be discussed with the council members and agreed upon under your direction, and that it will be consistent with the criteria adopted by the council in the draft regional master plan, revised as necessary to conform to any changes that you would consider for final adoption of the regional master plan.
Let's stay with that in a second. I think it's an important point, and I think it's probably a little different than what some of the public expectation has been. To me, it makes sense, but that the plan is not going to have a list of the sites that we're recommending.
That is correct. We do have mapping of the priorities for conservation. But when it gets to a block and lot level of information, the Act said a confidential list was to be sent to SADC and Greenacres. And that is our concern, that we meet the mandates of the Act and keep that confidentiality. Okay.
Excuse me. Eileen, would you explain why the confidentiality is important here?
I think the concern is over how the process would then undertaken by this is a voluntary process, the process of preservation, that you don't want to sort of, in a sense, show your hand in naming those block and lots, because there's a negotiation process that then takes place with Greenacres and SADC and willing landowners. So I think the concern is that is why the Act itself said that it should be confidential.
That's not inconsistent with what you do in the municipality or at a county level when you're considering acquiring property at any time for the same reason, but I thought it was good to get on the record why that is in there, so thank you.
Thank you.
And I think the notion...
It involves an Oprah request.
Well, it's confidential, I think.
Exactly, there's certain exceptions to Oprah.
And the notion is that the council, that this would be, I mean, we, the council members, would not be privy to this list either. We would be approving the criteria, but we would not be seeing the list because... Well, all of us would have conflicts in one way or another.
Really?
The Highlands Build Up Model. The Smart Growth Assessment provisions of the Act require that the Council identify areas of existing developed lands that may be appropriate for redevelopment, undeveloped lands in the planning area which are not environmentally constrained that could be developed, and propose densities for development, redevelopment, and voluntary TDR receiving areas based upon the findings of the resource assessment. And Council members have also asked us to do an analysis of what does the plan mean in terms of a build-out? What is the effect of the plan? And there was concerns raised about this pre-plan as well. You know, what would the build-out be if the plan was not in place, looking at the zoning that is in place in municipalities across the region? We are doing that work. There is a requirement for plan endorsement, a process which we're required to go through for a build-out analysis. So I wanted to bring you up to date to make sure you knew that the staff are working on that build-out analysis, and that we will have that, and we expect to have a draft ready for your review at the council meeting in April.
I mean, can I ask your analysis? Are you looking beyond just the current zoning? Are you looking at the infrastructure and, you know, water capacity and things like that?
Yes, we are.
The layers of the map?
We don't look at 51 layers. What we look at is what we're looking at, what are the limiting factors. When you look at all the information, you decide the limiting factor is probably your yield in terms of infrastructure for wastewater and public water and septic yields. Those become the limiting factors. So then what we do is we do look at all the issues, and everything is taken into consideration, but those become the limiting factors. So we look then at the zoning. That's one scenario. You look at another scenario then that looks at the plan and its impacts. And then, of course, you have to consider that the mandatory conformance for the preservation area and the optional, because then you're going to have different scenarios dependent on whether or not the planning area opts in and conforms to the plan.
Will you take into consideration all of the buffers and the environmental constraints that either exist now or that we're implementing as part of the plan?
Well, what happens there is in the preservation area, you're looking at the DEP rules, which basically, when you look at those septic densities of 1 to 25 in open lands and 1 to 88 in forested lands, that really does mean that you are taking into consideration those land constraints. And likewise, in the planning area, when we looked at, again, what the limiting factor was, when you look at the yields for septic and then you look at areas that are sewered, it does, in fact, then take into account those kind of constraints, because it allows for you to avoid those constraints and still have development opportunities, though limited and protective. Technical reports, just to bring you up to date, that we are updating those reports in terms of the changes that were made for a final draft. And again, that work has to continue until you have made your decision to consider adoption of the plan, because if there are changes again, you have to change some of the technical reports to mirror your changes. But that's ongoing work in this office. Growth in water deficit areas. Again, we've received many comments, and again from the council members as well. We just want to let you know that we are working on refining the policy to further address the differences in deficits between different areas, because some are very marginal, some are more than marginal. And so we're looking at exploring different methods to approach those differences. And we will come up with several options and a policy recommendation for the council consideration after the comment period has ended, because again, we're still receiving comments on those issues. Extension of sewers in the preservation area. This is a concern that we continue to hear, and we want to be very clear that the council was very clear to the staff on release of the final draft, that the provisions set forth in the Act were the provisions, and that the plan did not offer any opportunities outside of what the Act offers. If that is still not clear enough, then we have to make sure that the language is abundantly clear and uses the language directly from the Act and separates preservation from planning area, so that there is no doubt, because the Council made its decision clear to us. So what we're acknowledging here is if we continue to hear comments on this, it is we that must then look at the language in our plan and make sure it doesn't leave any room for further comment, because you've been clear. So we'll use the language from the Act. The Right to Farm Act, it is actually part of the conformance process. It's a mandatory requirement, but we've heard comments on that, and we're going to emphasise that because it is in the plan. But if we keep hearing comments that people don't find it to be there, we'll make sure it's emphasised in other areas as well, so that no one's left in doubt about the commitment to the right to farm. Protection of current farming practices. Again, we want to emphasise that those current farming practices are not changed under the plan unless you have a change in land use. Because we did hear comments about people who had agricultural practices right now and felt that maybe those would be changed upon adoption of this plan, that there would be implications for them. And we wanted to assure them. We did actually reach out to some of the people that commented in public hearings to offer them sort of a constituent call on those issues so that they could have their concerns addressed, because they were very immediate concerns, and we did reach out to them. Again, if we need to make that clearer, we will do so. I'll leave impervious surfaces and the development and redevelopment, because we're going to have a presentation on that. It is in the ED report. The creation of receiving zones for the transfer of development rights. The Act required that the Highlands Council conduct a process by which we would show where there was potential for receiving zones, and actually mandated a certain level that we had to achieve in the planning area. There have been many comments received about the mapping of potential HDC receiving areas. And what I wanted to emphasise to you is that just the mere mapping of them, they are not TDR receiving areas. They show where there is some potential in the region, which then requires further study. The potential in the mapping is a four-step process, and it isn't until you get to the fourth step of that process that we actually show capacity within the system to have potential for receiving areas. We didn't want to, if there's any opportunity through redevelopment opportunities to use TDR, we would certainly wish that communities would consider it. Because if they're going to do redevelopment, if indeed it is appropriate, and if it complies with the policies of the plan, then it would be great if they could actually use TDR, because the more receiving areas, the better for our program. But we want to be very clear that even if it is absolutely voluntary, and that is on the top of that page as well, it's potential for voluntary receiving areas, and that if a municipality is interested in that, that voluntary growth provision and the opportunity to use TDR, they don't have a green light just because there's something on the map that says there's potential there. It must go through a resource assessment. It must go through infrastructure capacity assessment, must be consistent and conform to the goals, policies and objectives of the regional master plan. Again, because we're receiving comments on that, in looking back at that area of the regional master plan, we can set out where those provisional areas are set forth. We can set forth again that process to make it very clear to everybody that all that is the beginning of a feasibility study. That's what that mapping is. They are not receiving areas. So we have to make sure that the language in the plan is very clear on that. The TDR program itself, I wanted to let you know that the staff spent sort of 2 days of dedicated work looking at the TDR program, working with Charlie Seaman, who's been our consultant on issues from the firm of Seaman & Larson, John Stokes from the Pinelands, Susan Kraft from the State Agricultural Development Committee. They were there because Charlie Seaman has experience nationwide on TDR programs, and both John Stokes and Susan Kraft have had real practical on-the-ground experience in the state of New Jersey. So we wanted to bring around the table those people that have that real experience to work with Chef LaJava, who's our expert on staff, working on these issues for us, and the architect, so to speak, of our program, working with experts such as Charlie, John, and Susan. We also brought in Ralph Siegel, who's the Executive Director of the Northern State Preservation Trust, representatives from the Office of Smart Growth, who work on TDR throughout the state of New Jersey. Our Chair, John Weingart, and Chair of the TDR Committee also attended part of the sessions. On the second day of that, those work sessions, we had representatives from the Farm Bureau. We had a representative who's part of the Highlands Coalition, and representatives from Environmental Federation, and consultants from Integra, who we've worked on this issue. The goal was to simplify the program and discuss the creation of a TDR bank and the capitalization of same. Now, we had committed at a prior TDR committee meeting to have another meeting where we brought back the public and had another look at that program. We are committed to that promise we made, committed to the commitment. So I wanted to make sure you knew that we had done further work, further analysis. Jeff has an in-house draft that he's working on to simplify the process, and we have a contract that we'll be discussing later on that really shows how we've simplified the process as well for the end user. But just to let you know that we will be having, that's one committee meeting that we've already promised to. So even though we spoke today, the chair spoke about the council working as a whole on issues, that's a commitment that was made. Of course, there's nothing stopping all council members attending those kind of committee meetings. But we will have that, and there'll be further study of that program. The Memorandum of Understanding with COA, we've continued to work on that. We've had a series of meetings with COA staff, and have a goal to have a draft of that for you as early as April. A comment letter on COA's proposed rules will be ready for council review, and the comment period for COA closes on 23rd of March. The chair did speak about that. That brings to the end my ED report. We did have the presentation pulled in at this time as well.
Well, let's see first if anyone has any questions on grants. Anyone on the phone? Can I ask again who was on the phone? Because there were some clicks there. And I was...
Debbie, I fell off and came back on.
Okay. But I was wondering, maybe we should go to the two voting items on the agenda now while we have a clear quorum, and then come back to the other the non-voting items. So if we could do that and move to items 9 and 10 on the agenda, starting with 9, the Highlands Planning Conformance Grant Program. So in our packets, we have a memo about it and a resolution, draft resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we have two planned performance grant programs that we were hoping to have resolutions enacting these today so that we can move forward on them. The first of those is an initial assessment grant program for municipalities with lands in the preservation area that have to conform to the regional master plan. And what this grant would allow them to do, it's the allocated funds per municipality are $15,000 per municipality. And they would use this grant to review their documents, such as the master plan, environmental resource inventory, development ordinances, etc., for consistency with the regional master plan. And it would assist municipalities in getting ready for that process of conformance, working with their professionals to see what basically the plan means to those municipalities. The amount is $850,000 for that. Some of what we see that it would include is that basic evaluation of current documents and regulations to see what changes would be necessary to conform to the regional master plan, determining what new items might be necessary in terms of ordinances. And, for example, there are issues such as water management plans that are required, so they might start to look at those processes working with their professionals. Preparing a short report and completing a conformance checklist, briefly outlining the plan performance implications for their municipality. It is not intended to be an in-depth study, but simply identifies those activities that the municipality or indeed county would undertake to conform and give sort of a brief synopsis for the purposes of their governing bodies and indeed the council on what the implications are of conformance. Also providing the opportunity to start that process of providing updates. So in other words, the factual information, if when they're looking at our information, if they see that we don't, for example, we haven't captured all the preserved lands on our mapping, that there's an opportunity to start the process then of looking at it and giving us that information. And if they think there are adjustments that they want to see, it gives that heads up that they might start looking at that and seeing what the implications are. The second part of the same programme really is the mini-grant programme. Of those municipalities in the Highlands region, 83 are located wholly or partially in the planning area. 36 are entirely in the planning area. Now, it makes sense to use the funds to look at your community comprehensively. So, in the case of the first grant, many of those lands, communities are split, but they could look at their lands comprehensively, and it's $15,000 to do so. In terms of the communities that are entirely within the planning area, they have an option of whether or not they want to conform. But to facilitate good decision-making and informed decision-making, we wanted those communities to have the opportunity to have up to $5,000 for those communities to look at the implications of the regional master plan in terms of their communities, and basically to say, what does the plan conformance process mean for us? You know, what are the implications and how can we best address the decision that's necessary here? Some of the things that we think would be included under this grant would be to examine the implications and determine the relative benefits of plan conformance for that municipality. To again prepare a short report or checklist briefly outlining the plan conformance implications. Again, not an in-depth study, but identifying activities that would have to be undertaken. And then also having a look at those, again, the factual information, because whether or not a town conforms, we want to make sure that our information is as accurate as possible. And map adjustments as well, that they, again, would look at it to consider what they would like to bring to the attention of the council. As we go around, and in the ED report, I did outline the significant number of meetings that have gone on since we last met. There have been municipal and county outreach meetings with Harding Township, Bedminster, Randolph, Sparta, Jefferson, Huntsman County, Tewksbury Township, Highbridge Borough. Highbridge Borough was a phone call. We didn't actually go out and meet with them yet. Lake Hopatcong Commission, the Borough of Hopatcong. We had our regular county planners meeting. We met with the mayor of West Milford and did a tour of that area as well. Had a Morristown informational meeting in Washington Borough. I bring that to your attention at this point because in those meetings and those informational meetings, which are primarily conducted by myself and Tom Borden, what we hear from municipalities is that they want to start that process and we want to assist them in good faith in working with their professionals to look at what the implications are for them.
So if I understand correctly, the mini-grants would be available to towns that are entirely in the planning area and the to basically for them to consider whether they want to apply to the other grants to continue, and that would be a likely trajectory of the town and the planning area to apply for the smaller grant and then either decide this wasn't something they wanted to go further with, or if they do want to go further, then they might likely be applied for the larger $15,000 grant.
Not the $15,000 grant. This is really to help them make the decision. What they would then be looking at is if they make the decision to opt in, then they would be able to use the funds that were allocated for the conformance process. So they could get more grant money from the council to go through the conformance process. This is really to help them make the decision as to whether they want to opt in or not.
I mean, you mean that's the 200,000?
That's the 200,000 for lands entirely within the planning area. For those that are split, they would use that 15 because you want them to look at their towns comprehensively. For those that are split and those entirely in the planning area, there's a larger amount of money because they do have lands that are mandated to conform.
Entirely the preservation area.
And those that are split as well.
Right.
They're mandated for those parts of their communities. But it wouldn't make sense for them to look at them separately and use two grants to look at an entire town. There's a larger amount of money for those communities that are split or entirely within the planning area. Sorry, entirely within the preservation area.
But is there going to be a different threshold for towns that have 3 square miles as opposed to towns that have 30 square miles?
The way that this is done, it's up to, so it's an amount up to 15,000. Sometimes it depends really on the amount of analysis that's necessary. We would work, as we have done with every grant, we'd work on doing procedures specific to each applicant and looking for what specifics they're going to look at, and that would determine the amount of money under these grants, the ceiling at this point being capped at 15,000 for one and 5,000 for the other.
Now, in earlier in your report, you said that from the state's budget, we had $10
million?
$12 million for grants, right?
That's for the Highland Protection Fund itself. Of that 12, our grant dollars are 4.4. That's how the legislature just allocated.
So we have $4 million for
Let's be clear. The $12 million is what's in the budget for the next fiscal year.
Right.
And we have, $8 million currently in our...
16.5.
Okay.
By the end of this fiscal year, we should have about $20 million for the 88 municipalities and the 7 counties to assist them through conformance.
So my second question then is, how did you determine that we'd spend a little more than $1 million for these grants? Because I think that if we're going to encourage the towns to do that, I think we have to give them an adequate funding to do this. And they're going to have less and less resources of their own to dedicate to this because they're getting less state aid and, you know, they're being under the gun because their budget's down.
Well, we realize this, and I think what's important to note is that these are not the funds for conformance. This is for consideration to start to get them to begin to see what the implications are for their municipality and allow them to start working now with their professionals. So it's really before they even get to the conformance process. It's for their professionals now to be looking at and saying, this is what it means for our community. Here's what the mapping says. Here's what the policies are underlying the information we have. And this is what we need to consider. So as we go out with these informational meetings, municipalities and counties are asking us questions specific to their area. This would give them some sort of advance money to start that work. We do have the funding to defray the reasonable costs associated with conformance. That's the next step.
So let's say a town's in the planning area. Do they go and ask for a mini grant first, and what does this do for them?
They would ask for a mini grant, and then that would allow them to first of all work with us and say, this is what we're going to use this mini grant for. As we do with any grant, we have to have the process laid out clearly. And then what we would do is, and that comes before the council.
And how much can
for
that
approval.
Be?
For the planning area communities, we've laid out 5,000
right.
per community, 5, and we multiplied it by the number to get to the 200.
We did buffer as well.
We did put buffer in there, yes.
Because we allowed for someone petitions for if a certain town wanted to request more for certain circumstances.
But that would come back to you, as we've done in similar grants.
We have a draft of...
I just wanted to follow the process. Yeah. So they get the mini grant, and then they use that to just look and determine if they want to go further?
Correct.
Right, okay. So
it's
then
really good faith, maybe, in a sense, because they trust their professionals, and they want to work with them and get advice from their professionals on the implications of the plan.
So then if they think they want to go further, then they ask for a bigger grant.
They can do with a letter of intent, and we can start the process where we would lay forth for them, here's what you're going to have to do. We work together with them. This is what this is going to mean to you. This is maybe it's a reevaluation of your master plan, new ordinances, and new inventories. We'd lay forth that, and then the cost associated with the reasonable cost associated, and the grant monies to cover those reasonable costs as laid out in the plan.
And then if they do all that and they still want to go, then they would come and ask for a conformance grant in order to actually update their master plan.
No, the second step that I laid out was the conformance process and the monies to defray their costs.
But I think what's important is this step could happen before we adopt a plan, that a town could be looking now at the implications of the Act and could, undoubtedly wouldn't want to apply and to actually come into conformance until they saw what was in the final plan, but they could start thinking about it.
Just as you do a TDR feasibility grant, as you look to see, what they do in the municipality, it doesn't mean that they have to be a TDR receiving area. They've taken the monies to examine the feasibility. In this way, they get a mini-grant which allows them to consider the implications in order to help them make an informed decision as to whether they wish to opt in or not.
The question is $15,000 enough then to do what they need to do to be in conformance?
It's very difficult to judge if it is, you know, exactly what that right amount is, but it's more than they're getting right now. It certainly gets people thinking. And in terms of making sure that you focus, it will focus on the tasks and the amount of money, remembering that many of those professionals are already looking at the plan, looking at the implications, obviously, as we receive these comments from municipalities, but allows them to do a more in-depth study. And we worked in-house and one of our planners has done work with municipalities. She's been a municipal planner. We have a team of planners, professional licensed planners on staff. And so we did consider what we think would be a reasonable amount to offer for this process.
Well, now you know, $15,000 if a planner's billing you $100 an hour with his expenses, that's only 150 hours. That's only, you know, 3 weeks and whatever.
Mr. Chairman, may I speak? I want to add on to what Mimi's saying. As somebody that contracts with professionals for local planning, there isn't much that can get done for $15,000. I think the amount's too low. This isn't a simple plan. I mean, for them to answer some of the questions that I think they're going to want to answer for themselves, it's going to require quite a bit of work. This, given the complexity of what our regional master plan is and all the data layers, I mean, if I'm a municipal official and I want a meaningful answer, not a superficial answer from one of my professionals, it's going to take more than $15,000 in what I call a look-see. Even figure out whether we want to proceed. So I would suggest we reconsider this amount for planning area municipalities.
Well, let me do this. We have a draft resolution here. Why don't we get it on the table, and then if people want to consider amending it or not approving it, we can do that. Does someone would like to introduce the resolution?
I'll move the resolution.
I'll second it.
Okay. So the resolution does call for that amount. You said there were discussions with the planning staff on staff. Have there been discussions with any town officials or planners about this amount or amounts like this?
We've talked with municipalities about, we've talked about setting up this process, and in fact the letter you referred to earlier was because of an informational meeting where we suggested these monies might be available, and they were already requesting it before you've actually taken action. Certainly, we've received a lot of interest from municipalities. As to the exact amount, no, we haven't done that work. But I think what we really wanted to do was, again, provide an initial amount for just consideration. It doesn't get to doing any of the in-depth work. And given that you've already received comments from municipalities, you know they are already looking at the implications. But we just wanted to make sure that they made the best decision possible, informed decision, and offer them some assistance.
Chairman, I think that it's important to recall what you were saying, that there is additional funding available, and there's an opportunity to come back to the council to request that additional funding based on certain circumstances that arise. That's correct, is that?
Yes.
All right. So if this resolution is passed, for example, and our community undertakes that look-see, as it's been called, and decides that they need more money to get a more comprehensive view, I think that they can certainly come back and consider that at that time.
Let me also follow up something Tom said, because the resolution doesn't speak to a specific amount for town. So I gather from what you said, the letters going out to towns would say, we anticipate grants no greater than $5,000, $15,000, but we would entertain requests for petitions for a higher amount.
Exactly. We did the same thing with the TDR feasibility grant program, and actually this council approved an additional amount on a case-by-case basis for towns that requested additional funding for the TDR feasibility.
And so those amounts were what?
That was $25,000 in one case of Clifton, and they requested additional funding, but we required the town to justify and then the council to approve. So all of these grants would be approved by the council. Instead of town or county.
So there is no limit then?
Well, what we've done with all our grant programs, we set a dollar amount to begin the grant process. And then the council approves each and every grant that's issued. To the extent that the council realizes halfway through the grant process that additional funds should be allocated towards it, we will do that following your direction.
Okay. So if a large number of towns respond and say we're applying $15,000, that's what would happen. If we started to get nothing but requests for more than that, we'd know we had too low a number.
And then we would have to come back and increase, if the decisions, we'd have to increase the $850,000
right.
number.
Right. Yes. And along the way, we'd have to approve each individual grant.
But that's the part of the resolution that would have to be amended subsequently. It would have to be that dollar amount allocated.
I'm just a little concerned, though, that, you know, I understand what you're saying, that a municipality will read your letter, and they may not take into account the fact that you said, well, they can request additional. They'll say, 15 grand, not nearly enough. I got more important things to do or whatever. I'm afraid we're not providing enough.
Well, I think the reality is most towns in the Highlands region are thinking about this on some level, and a fair number are probably paying their professionals to do this without anybody from the Highlands Council at this point.
I wouldn't bet. Well, not in this time of austerity.
Can I make one suggestion? Perhaps what we could do is, this allocates only $1 million as of July 1, $21 million will be available. Right. Perhaps we could make it clear in the letter that during the plan conformity process, the remaining $20 million will be available, depending on how many towns form, that dollar amount is going to be allocated. So we can say, hypothetically, should half the towns conform, this many dollars can be available per town, to make it clear that there are substantial dollars available for conformance. This initial grant is simply that.
Yeah, I'd be a little careful on that, particularly for planning area towns. They could want to conform in 3 years, and we'd want to be able to entertain that.
And what we've conceived is that the conformance approval will have actual dollars allocated at that time, but to the extent you want to make it clear that there is substantial dollars, we could make that clear.
I share John's reticence about putting that in. You know, I've got $1 million to spend on this project, and how much is it going to cost me?
$1 million.
Right.
Other comments on the resolution? Comments from anyone on the phone?
But I do think, Mr. Chairman, I think this is an important resolution to adopt at this time because it is a start. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to do is get started on this.
If there are no other comments, I'll do this as a roll call. I'm sorry. Yes. Public comments, yes.
Hi, Wilma for New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I am thinking that this differential funding for towns that are totally in the planning area versus towns that are partially in the preservation area, maybe sending the wrong message. The towns that have land in the preservation area know they already have to, they're mandatory conformance in the preservation area. But the towns in the planning area don't have that kind of pressure to get involved with the process at all. And I think we certainly hope that this is going to be a plan that includes all the towns in the planning area, not just the towns that have land in the preservation area. For the towns in the planning area, it is the planning that is going to mean whether this area has more preservation than it would under simply municipal master plans as they exist today. So I think the towns in the planning area are the ones that need the financial incentive to take a really good look at whether they want to conform or not. And I think $5,000 is not going to be enough to provide any kind of incentive for them to really take a look at it. I really think that either the funding should be equal or, you know, possibly more. But I think that, you don't want to throw away money to towns that are, you know, just accept the grant and then don't really do that much work and then say, well, no thanks, we decide we don't want to conform. But I think that, you know, there could be some kind of a look at how serious the towns appear to be about really considering it, you know, how they seem to be approaching it. I just think that maybe that should be the same amount as the cap for all the towns, rather than having a very small thing dangling out there for the planning area towns, because I don't think, I mean, I think it's just really important that they, even though they don't have the mandatory timeline and everything, that that they get involved and that there be some kind of a dollar amount that doesn't look like they are the low man on the totem pole, or that it's not really important, when in fact it's really important, because the towns that have land in the preservation area, they do have the DEP rules in the preservation area, so there's already protections in that. So.
Interesting point.
Thanks.
John Millay, Raritan Highlands Compact, but I'm going to wear my Burns Township committeeman hat. I could say that as a town that's completely in the planning area, we are very much concerned about the Highlands. We have our staff, our planners, our zoning officials looking at it. And the motivation is not strictly monetary. We obviously are very worried about what the effects will be vis-a-vis COA. And other things like that, other regulatory issues that are coming down from the state. So I would say that I don't think that Wilma needs to worry about the motivation of people in the planning area as to what, you know, I think if to the extent that we're typical, we have very much a concern about what you folks are doing and what the consequences, pro and con, would be of opting in, to the point we are already spending time and money on doing this, especially since it just happens that we are getting to start on another master plan this year. So I would say that the extent that you could engage us to whatever extent monetarily to help defray the expenses of factoring in the Highlands regulations into the master plan process, into the COA process and all of that, I think that would be a big help. So speaking as one of the 88 communities, I can say that we'd probably be very interested in something like that to help us make a good decision.
Thank you. Other comments? Yes.
Susan Buck Oxford, I certainly agree with the conversation of the dollar amount, to make whether this makes sense or not, but I feel strongly that it's very premature to be offering this money, which will disappear out of the state coffers like so many other dollars do, until the plan is adopted. Once the plan is adopted and there's concrete things, there's memorandums of understanding with COA, with all the other folks involved, we know what's happening with all these other programs, that's the time that it may be worthwhile beginning to spend the money, but no sooner than that, otherwise it's just money down the toilet.
What was the thinking in terms of the planning area towns, and how do you respond to Wilma's comment?
In response to Wilma's comment, Tom and I were talking and saying that what you could consider is that they use the mini-grant to consider conformance, and having done that step, delivered their report, they could then move into the assessment grant at 10,000 so that it would be equal then to 15, you know, using the two. If you wanted to do that, then it would be a two-step process for them, which makes sense, because one is really just looking at it, looking at the implications. The second is doing an assessment, which is more detail-oriented, which is why we have a difference between the 5 and the 15, because an initial assessment is far more detailed than just that look-see that the planning area are doing. So if you wanted to do that, we could change, and now therefore be resolved, we could up that 850,000 to a million, which would account for an opportunity to have a two-step process for the planning area municipalities.
And that means I don't think that's quite enough, though. I mean, the 36 towns and the 10,000.
360,000 more for them.
Or 360,000, okay.
It's not quite, if you wanted to go with the full 360,000, just add this.
And when we say planning area towns, we mean 100% planning area.
That is correct.
All others are either total preservation area or mixed preservation and planning.
Yes.
So the letter to a totally planning area town then would say
that there's an offer of an initial mini grant at this point, and the town would be, if the town did that, they would be then become eligible for further grants, and so we could sort of lay that out a little. But start them off with the 5,000, which requires the report and requires us to see what they've done, what the implications are for them, and then if they're interested and going the next step, they say, now we want to do a more in-depth assessment. And that brings it to an equal level with the preservation areas.
It also kind of simplifies the process and everybody's understanding what's going on.
It's two-step as well, and it allows, we think it put certain controls in place to make sure certain works.
Mr. Chairman, I would accept that amendment to the resolution.
So the total amount would be 850 plus 360.
Okay.
Well, no, actually the total amount. So the total amount would go up 360 from what it was.
From the 850 plus 360, right?
Plus the 200 that was in the mini grant.
Okay.
Correct.
Right, plus 200.
That's 1,410,000 total.
That's all I got.
So if you want to keep round numbers, or it's up to you, whatever.
We had rounded it up. Like that would be, so be
1.5 million. And then we'll adjust the other lines if you want.
Okay, so is everyone clear on what that change would be? And do you accept that as the seconder?
I accept that. My motion is amended.
Okay.
It's only money.
Well, with that change, are there any more public comments on this?
I would like to say I'm somewhat disappointed that an analysis was not done with the municipalities to get a really good sense of what that first step might cost if everyone were to do it or half of them would do it. I think that should have been something that should have taken place first, so we wouldn't be having this kind of discussion now. Well, maybe this is enough, maybe this is not enough.
Well, we do have professional planners on the staff, including one who was a private planner as recently as several 2 months ago, I think. So
yeah. The other part of this is that experience with the process of plan endorsement showed that it was so incredibly different one municipality from another. But that I think it was you were saying yourself, if you don't establish some controls, it can become unwieldy. We were concerned to protect the monies for conformance, for the actual work for conformance.
I understand that.
But I respect your
interest. Other comments? Okay. This is a roll call. Kurt Allstadt?
Yes.
Tracy Carluccio?
Yes.
Tim Dillingham?
Yes.
Janice Kovach? Janice, are you still here? No. Mimi Letts?
Yes.
Debbie Pascarelli?
Yes.
Eric Peterson? Jack Schreier?
Yes.
Tahisha Way?
Yes.
And I will vote yes, so that's 8 votes, so it passes. Thank you, and let's turn to the other, the vertices contract, which is number 10 on the agenda, is the other voting matter.
Second resolution for you is to amend an existing contract with Vertices LLC. And we have an existing contract with Vertices LLC, and what the council has been in the habit of doing is looking at the work, the performance, and then modifying grants when necessary. Vertices LLC is the consultant that did the property search tool for us, and we actually have recently, as recently as this morning, have updated the aerial photos on that. The consultant called us to tell us those have been updated. So I invite you all to look at the property search tool again, and you'll see that the aerials have been updated since you looked perhaps as late as yesterday. This is a tool that is being very widely used. We find that out from working with the communities, talking to constituents that call in. It's been very, very useful. One of the tax collectors in our communities contacted us because you have the ability using that tool to measure which properties are within the 200 foot radius and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of utility in that particular tool. We wanted to advance to you the opportunities to build on that tool in three different ways. The first is for consistency determination. In order to allow public access and municipal access and anybody within the region to look at a block and lot level and to look at the region and be able to call up more information. Currently, what you can see is you can see whether the land is in preservation or planning area. You can see which of the overlay zones it falls into. You can do certain measurements, things of that, and you have certain Mod 4 data applicable to that particular block and lot. Further utility would allow the site to show what the constraints are on the site. The different layers of information we have available would be readily available for all of those in the public to look at. The information is all publicly available, but not so easily accessible and not at a block and lot level. And that's what we would be allowed to be able to bring to the public through enhancement of this product. Also, in terms of TDR, we can see that we've talked about the complexity of the program necessitated by the incredible variance in values across the region. But for the end user, a person within the Highlands wanting to see if they're in a sending area, how many credits their land they would get for their land, instead of going through some sort of a mathematical equation as we were looking at, because you've got that variety of values, what they would do is use this tool, put in their block and lot, and it would show them what the TDR values would be, not how many credits, and there'd be obviously a value established with that credit, so they'd know what the value was, and then they would verify that with the council. But again, it'd be very simple for them. They would just key in the block and lot, they'd get the information straight back. Factual updates for counties and towns, again, very important, so that they could have access to this information, all of our information, and an easy way to look at making factual corrections. There'd be a process set forth, there'd be a certain authorization for users that would then update information, which would only be accepted upon verification by the staff. But again, it allows transparency, easy access. The tool currently uses Google Earth, and again, this is to be efficient in terms of spending. If there's something that's readily available and that you can use, you don't have to recreate it. And so this is using, currently it's using Google Earth. So those are the applications that we see that this could be enhanced, this site. And we're asking the council to consider in the amount of $90,000 and modifying this contract so that the vertices who do update and maintain that site for us could do this further enhancement.
My understanding is, when the Budget Committee considered this contract originally, the anticipation was that this might cost up to $250 or something like that. Right. So this is still under that total amount.
Right.
Especially the latter one of these three is really initial testing of the update process for open space and for your infrastructure. We plan to build on this framework over time.
We have a resolution in our packet, so someone like to introduce it.
I'll make a motion.
I'll second it.
Okay. Comments? Questions?
Is this relevant to the information that we have from Rutgers Neighborhood and the redevelopment agency that was talking about the lack of utility of open space and versus buildable land? You know what I'm referring to?
I actually don't, sir. Sorry.
I'll share that with
you. Thank you. It's really, as I say, to give people access to our information and to keep our information updated. Our staff are very, Roger Curran, who leads this unit, is very, always sort of maintained that we must, it's not just the collection of data and the analysis of the data, but it's the updating of that data so that we stay current and we serve the municipalities and counties. And we're looking for a platform that's the easiest way to do that, and yet transparent to all members of the public that have access to a computer.
Okay. And just to add one thing, it's the key from our perspective is that using this framework allows for interactivity, that we can post updated information that municipalities, towns, and the public can say, this needs to be updated, and use that information interactively. That's hopefully will improve the planning for the region.
questions. So if a town wants to update information, they send it to council staff and council staff enters it, or is it directly interactive?
They would use the site to do it, but it wouldn't be accepted and the change is done until we have verified the information. And we would have to have a process for authorized users, you know, from the municipality so that the changes could be made. Anybody else can see and access the information, but any changes or suggested changes would have to come through an authorized user.
And I'll give you a good example. If it was a particular parcel that was bought from for open space, they could click on that parcel and actually provide a framework, any framework or supporting documentation via the site.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments, council members? Anyone on the phone have comments or questions? Public comments? Okay. This again is a roll call. Kurt Alstead?
Yes.
Tracy Carluccio?
Yes.
Tim Dillingham?
Yes.
Mimi Letts?
Yes.
Debbie Pescarelli?
Yes.
Jack Schreier?
Yes.
Deisha Way?
Yes.
Anyone else on the phone I missed? Okay. And I'll vote, so that, and I'll vote yes, so that also passes. Okay. Let's return now to the second part of the Executive Director's Report, item 7.
Thank you. This, in a sense, is two-step. When I, in going through the executive director's report, I drew your attention to issues issues that we've received comments from the council as well as public members. And we've received comments, and I know many of the council members have received comments as well, on the question of impervious surface as it relates to redevelopment opportunities. What I want to do is to use a PowerPoint to sort of frame the conversation so you understand why we are going through this process, and then introduce to you a method that was devised by Jim Hutzelman on our staff, an engineer on our staff. He devised the method for calculation of impervious surface. But I want to first frame the discussion so you see, you know, why we're going through this process. And when we get to the very technical application of this process, I'm going to ask Dan Van Abs, the Senior Director of Science and Planning, and Jim to step up so that if there are technical questions, you will have their technical expertise.
Unless you're doing this from the beginning, can you just go through the context of this? This went through the natural resources.
Are
you
ready? Okay. Yeah. That's that.
Okay.
I realized you were not. So this is a status report on where we are with the designation of Highlands redevelopment areas and the methodology to go through the process. And again, now just to put it in context, as the Chair asked, the Highlands Act includes a goal for the Regional Master Plan for both preservation and planning areas. It's Section 10 of the Act, which speaks to promoting brownfield remediation and redevelopment. In the Regional Master Plan, the Council is required to identify existing developed areas capable of sustaining redevelopment activities and investment. Highlands redevelopment areas in the preservation area. The Highland Act allows the Highlands Council, in conjunction with municipalities in the preservation area, to identify areas in which redevelopment shall be encouraged in order to promote the economic well-being of the municipality, provided that the redevelopment conforms with the goals of the preservation area and this Act, and with New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection rules. I'll emphasise that because as we go through this and we get to the methodology that we're proposing, I want to make sure that we keep in mind that it's one step in a process and that we are still required to conform with the goals of the preservation area and the Act and DEP rules. The Act specifies that any areas identified for possible redevelopment pursuant to that subsection will be either a brownfield site designated by the Department of Environmental Protection, or a site at which at least 70% of the area thereof is covered with impervious surface. We have in the Regional Master Plan a redevelopment program. That program states that the Regional Master Plan strives to accommodate regional growth and development needs, primarily through the reuse and redevelopment of previously developed areas, including brownfields, greyfields, and underutilized sites. This obviously is coming from the Act. These areas generally have access to existing utility and transportation infrastructure and often are located in or near existing communities. As they've already been developed, the sites will have comparably fewer environmental constraints than undeveloped areas, and the reuse of developed lands conserves natural resources and maximizes infrastructure investments. However, not all such sites are in locations conducive to redevelopment, especially where redevelopment could harm surrounding environmentally sensitive resources. So we never lose sight of the goals of the Act and the need to consider each site individually to make sure that it is conforming to both the Act and the plan. Highlands redevelopment in the preservation area. The general criteria for Council's approval of a Highlands redevelopment site in the preservation area include that the site would meet impervious surface or brownfields requirements, that the redevelopment will not impair any Highlands resources, that the redevelopment is consistent with resource protection and smart growth goals of the Regional Master Plan, that there is sufficient water supply and wastewater capacity, and other unique or mitigating criteria determined by Council based on the Regional Master Plan policies and objectives. Again, this is to try to call out the fact that this is a multi-step process and none of the protections must be afforded to each individual site. In the preservation area, again, the Highlands Act specifies that any major Highlands development in the preservation area comply with NJDEP's rules. The Act includes a redevelopment waiver, which may be allowed on a case-by-case basis for redevelopment in certain previously developed areas identified by you, the Council. The grant of a waiver shall be conditioned upon NJDEP's determination that the redevelopment meets the required protective findings to the maximum extent possible. So even when DEP considers waivers, it's not sort of a blanket waiver from the DEP rules. It's only that which is considered necessary and appropriate to allow that redevelopment to move forward. The Highlands Council received inquiries in 2005 from property owners, including Heath Village and Borealis, seeking a determination on the basis of that 70% that opportunity, using that 70% impervious surface to do redevelopment projects. The Natural Resources Committee issued draft Highlands redevelopment area procedures in May 2007. They were put up on the website, out for public comment. We received numerous requests in those public comments then to clarify the mapping method for impervious surface determinations. The Natural Resources Committee issued draft impervious surface method in February 2008 for public release. There was a discussion at the December meeting of the Natural Resources Committee of this method. It was a discussion in public. Many of the public questioned the method there and had answers given to them. Subsequent to that, the committee members wanted to see the memo and have input into that memo before it was drafted and put on the website for public comment. So December was the meeting where that method was first discussed, and it was in February with the input of committee members into the draft for public comment. Now, the public comment closes on that draft impervious surface method March 3rd, and I wanted to bring that to your attention so that it isn't necessary to come to a decision today, because we need to take in those public comments as well for your consideration before you come to a determination. Now we're going to get to where we discuss the simplified site analysis method, that which I told you was devised by Jim. I would ask Jim and Dan to come up into the hot seats so that if we get into technical issues, they can respond. The first issue is that there were concerns and comments that we were looking at a definition for impervious surface. We are not in any way changing the definition. The definition is set forth by the Highlands Act. And what it says, and it's in the draft that is up on the website, that the actual definition from the Act, and it is on this slide, impervious surface means any structure, surface, or improvement that reduces or prevents absorption of stormwater into land and includes porous paving, paver blocks, gravel, crushed stone, decks, patios, elevated structures, and other similar structures, surfaces, or improvements. It's a two-part definition, and from our perspective, the key is reduction or prevention of absorption. Specific surfaces outlined in the definition are examples. So, you know, there can be other ones that we could consider. And herein lies the difficulty, and this was what the applicant said, that we're looking at these, at the process, was how then does one determine that 70%?
What's the link in the Act between the two parts of the definition?
The second bullet there is just really calling your attention to the language of reduction or prevention of absorption. The definition is entirely what's above. This is a default method that we're proposing to you today. An applicant can go through an analysis and do site soil borings, etc., to determine what the impervious surface is, subject to approval by the council, and the staff would look at the methodology employed. But this is a default method of doing the same, and we believe it is a conservative method. And you can see emphasized on this slide that this method is only for Highlands development, redevelopment area designation. It is not applicable to new development. New development is regulated based on impervious surface creation, nothing that's existing. So there's no need to estimate or determine directly based on planned site development. So this is only for, and it's really the gateway of the process to look at the analysis of that 70% of impervious surface. This slide here shows you the real complexity of the issue. The picture to the right is an aerial view of the Heath site. It is a senior citizen residential project. It shows that there are a number of buildings, a number of connecting roadways, a number of parking areas. And the difficulty was here, if you're looking at this site and trying to determine that precise 70% and draw the area around it so that you've got a building envelope that allows for the redevelopment process to take place. Using only what we can call hardscape surfaces to determine the redevelopment can produce unwieldy results. So if you look at the blue, you're looking at the hardscape. Hardscape would be your buildings, your asphalt roadways, your parking areas. Those are hardscape. But remembering, the definition from the Act, those compacted soils that are around a building certainly could impede the absorption of water into the ground. Also, if you consider pathways, well-trodden pathways between buildings, what the Act itself, the example given, the gravel driveways. So there are additional areas outside of the hardscape areas that can be determined to also meet the definition of the Act. The redevelopment boundary that's drawn and that would determine the redevelopment area obviously should be based on sound principles. And so we're looking for a methodology to calculate the impervious surface in concert with those sound planning principles. The proposed method looks at those two categories of impervious surfaces, the hardscape, which are the buildings, the parking lots, sidewalks, patios, and other paved or covered surfaces. And then those other impervious areas, land areas where fill, alteration or compaction of soil, reduces or prevents absorption. The hardscape is obviously easy to delineate. The other impervious is where the difficulty lies. So delineating other impervious, the intent is a conservative approach that is realistic given the nature of those developed sites, the soil compaction, use of gravel, etc. Direct measurement is very expensive, hard for the Highlands Council to confirm, and really not needed at the site designation step, remembering that this is just the way in. You've then got to go through the resource protections, you've got to go through the capacity within the systems. You've got to work with both the Highlands Council does the designation, and then it goes to the Department of Environmental Protection for those limited waivers necessary for that redevelopment to take place. So the option here that we're looking at is to look at the effects on stormwater runoff. So you define the area that would create a very small 1% increase in runoff volume beyond the runoff from the hardscape area. So it's very much capped and defined how broad you can or how far you can look at those other areas that are not hardscape. Using TR55 NRCS curve numbers with limits and New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection Water Quality Design Storm. These are the methods employed by Jim in this analysis. TR55 is recognized as with empirical evidence and used by New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in their stormwater calculations. And so then we get into, I'll see and show you how this works out. In the first example, and we'll show you a picture afterwards, or a drawing of this, you have a building of 40,000 square feet. You have a parking lot of 10,000 square feet, so your total hardscape is 50,000 square feet. Your runoff from those hardscape areas in the design storm is 4,312 cubic feet. Your target then for other impervious, because you have a maximum, we've established a limit, so this is conservative, is that 1%, 43 cubic feet. The lawn area on sea soil with a curve number of 74 and would lead you then to an other impervious of 7,100 square feet. So your total default impervious surface would be 57,100 square feet. And this is what it looks like, showing the area there. You've got the roof area. You can see where the hardscape areas are, the parking lot and that roof area. And the other area, you would then be able to see that's the 70%, and then you can designate your site redevelopment area. Example two is, again, you've got your roof and your parking area of 440,890 square feet. You've got railroad tracks. We'll again show you a picture. This is a real-life situation. You've got railroad tracks of 94,750 square feet, and that gives you then your total hardscape area in square footage. Your runoff for that area is 40,399 cubic feet measured in the design storm. Your target is, again, capped at that 1% for other impervious areas, 404 cubic feet. Your lawn area on mapped B soil is modified to that curve number of 74 based on the sea soil to reflect compacted quality. And that gives you your other impervious of 65,708 square feet, giving you a total impervious surface of 601,356 square feet. And what that looks like, what that looks like is this. This is, again, a real-life situation. The hardscape surfaces on this site, the site is sort of bordered around by the four roads. Am I correct in that? Yes. Okay, the four roads around the actual site. So that open field area is actually part of the site. I want you to be able to see the entire site. The striped areas are the hardscaped areas. And then using the methodology to include those other impervious surfaces, but only up to that 1%, that would be those areas shown in yellow. And that then would be the default method, which would show you that 70%. Again, then that would allow you then to build on this and designate your redevelopment area. The alternative default method is a site-specific analysis of all surfaces other than hardscape, detailed findings of soil density, etc., to prove that impervious surfaces are greater than provided by this method. And that is at the discretion of the applicant. We believe what we have here is a conservative method which allows us to move forward on the mandates of this Act, but again, only allows for the applicant to get to the designation process. Then there's a whole other process they have to go through. And that brings us to the end of the slideshow, and I offer it back to the chair, and you have Don and Jim to answer any specific.
You might want to add to.
I think the one thing that I would add is a point that Eileen made in the slideshow is that there are soils shown on properties that are A and B class soils, in other words, fairly pervious soils. And because we're dealing with the question of how much area should be considered impervious because you've had a reduction in the ability of the soils to pass water, to infiltrate water, it doesn't make sense to measure things out as an A or B soil. And so we, in all cases, default to at least a C soil because that recognizes the compaction of the soils that we're dealing with. If the site is already shown on the soil survey as a C soil, it remains as a C soil. If it's already shown on the soil survey as a D soil, which is nearly impenetrable soil, it stays as a D soil. It doesn't go back to a C soil. So we're always erring on the side of a reduced land area as opposed to an increased land area.
And in order to get to A or B, for example, the applicant will have to prove that case.
If they can prove to us that it's an A or B soil currently, then they've just proved that it's not impervious. So that would actually remove land from the calculation.
What's the basis for 1% as opposed to half a percent or 5%?
That's a policy call, very frankly. The starting point was to have a de minimis increase in runoff, and so the 1% was chosen as a fair approximation of de minimis. And so in terms of whether it could be something else, yes, it could certainly be something else, but that's where we landed for the work. Among other things, we ran some calculations, and this seemed to come out with results that made empirical sense when you actually look at a site. You didn't wind up with areas that were, you know, just 50 inches from the side of the building, because we know perfectly well the soils are compacted beyond that point from all the construction equipment. And it didn't result in areas that were trailing off into the woods and the fields and so on, because that, of course, is likewise not appropriate under this method.
And I'd just like to add that there's also conditions on which those areas can be added. First of all, they have to be what we call hydrologically connected, meaning they have to drain to a common point. They have to be adjacent to the hardscape areas. And they have to be areas that are continuously disturbed, such as grass areas. They can't be natural vegetated areas, such as woods. And as the rules read, the impervious area has to be in place as of August 2004. So it doesn't enable people to disturb their sites now and then have that be counted as impervious areas. And that's in the rules.
Obviously, no.
We have the photography at this point. You just heard it, that it's up on the website, and you can take a look at it. It is a critical point because you only get one bite at the apple. And under the DEP rules, once you've gone through the redevelopment waiver process, I believe I'm correct in stating that the remainder of the land goes under a deed restriction. That's it. You're done.
And actually, in reference to that, thank you, Don, I would like to add that when we looked at the Heath site, they actually own other large tracts of forested land that has steep slopes as well. And when we were working with them, we asked would they agree to deed restricting those lands in perpetuity. They're separate block and lots, and they did, at the meeting we had, agree that that would be something they would consider doing.
Are you asking about Heath Village? Are you using that as an example because they have applied for some expansion of their facilities?
Yes, and because they're currently working with us, they're sort of a pilot project, as is the other real-life slide that we showed you there. And the engineer for Heath was at the NRC, the Natural Resources Committee, meeting in December, and did speak at that meeting. And so he's been, frankly, eager for us to keep proceeding because they have been working with us since 2005.
I just want to clarify, this definition that you just presented, will that apply to new development?
Yeah.
Or just to redevelopment?
That was one of the slides, meaning it was very clear that it absolutely does not apply to redevelopment, and that it's not the definition, it's the method. The definition is that from the Act.
So for new development, it will adhere to whatever the Act says.
That's correct.
Correct.
Well,
without any of these additional constraints.
Both of them adhere to what the Act says. This is a method of interpreting what the Act says based on a longstanding existing facility.
Right.
With a new development, you know exactly what the impervious surface is, you know exactly what the disturbed areas are, you know exactly what the compacted areas are going to be, because it's happening right in front of you. And so it's a lot easier to deal with. So in both cases, we're using the same definition. In this case, we're just having to interpret it.
In new development, as well, you have a
probably just jump in on that point for a second.
Tim, go ahead.
I guess a couple things. One, when the committee did discuss this in December and decided to release public comment, I just want to make sure that the council understands that we didn't feel that our deliberations or consideration of this was completed. And I think there actually were some specific requests to have the, after the public comment had been taken, brought it back to the committee to consider it. So I don't think we see that process as closed there. I think one of the policy questions that needs to be discussed out there is the interpretation of the definition. I think there's a lot of sense in Eileen's characterization of, you know, the need to have a metric which is usable. But I do think it's a fairly expansive definition to include the idea of compacted soils under the terminology of surface. So I think we have there's a policy decision there about this idea of inclusion of non-hardscape surfaces in the calculation that I hope we will think through and continue to discuss before we finalize the decisions on this. But, you know, stormwater management perspective, I think it's very well established that those soils do function that way. I just think we need to make sure we think through all the implications of that policy decision. And as the slide show indicates, right now we are talking about this very strictly in the terms of the redevelopment proposals, but it's something to keep in mind.
I think both a policy and a legal determination to make sure I think some of the public comments, at least at the public hearings, were not cognizant of the fact that this was building from fairly specific language in the Act.
Just
my understanding is that we're building the policy discussion and then the metrics and the methodologies that follow from it on the interpretation definition that's in the slideshow. And really, the terminology is the word surface that reduces or prevents absorption. And I think it's reasonable to discuss whether or not that word surface means man-made surface or any, you know, compacted soils, which I guess you could consider to be a surface. But I guess my point is I think there is a policy decision in that interpretation that we ought to talk about.
I just want to let you know that I did send the PDF of the PowerPoint to members this morning so that they could follow.
Do all of us have it?
I sent it this morning. Yeah, to everybody. Yes, to the house.
Good. Check one off the list. I was going
to.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple questions. I think there are some implications of the use of this default method that we should look at pretty closely. One is a question that I asked when we discussed this at the December meeting and then after in our discussion as committee members. And that is, does this mean then when the calculation is done about a site to find out whether or not it's 70% impervious, that then once you count the areas that are, say, compacted soils, for instance, and not necessarily hardscape, once you count them as impervious surface, then does that mean that that will get counted into the calculation that will decide whether or not this is a redevelopment site based on whether or not this is 70% impervious?
It becomes part of the question of what is the impervious surface and therefore is part of that calculation. That's correct.
Well, I think it's important for the council to realize then that by making this decision to use this default method, that then we're automatically including lands that don't show up as hardscape right now as impervious surface, and therefore we are then really increasing the redevelopment sites that we'll be dealing with as a council, because more sites will meet the definition of 70% impervious now. And I think that the danger in that, and I would like to explore a little bit, you know, what the advantage really is of the default method besides making it easier, which I understand that. And I understand a level playing field is important and, you know, having an unwieldy approach is harder. But what is the advantage of doing this when we're now going to automatically be increasing the number of redevelopment sites in the Highlands that makes it eligible for all the relaxed approach that redevelopment sites allow over using in situ analysis? Because the in situ analysis, where you actually do the soil test to find out is that area that's not a hardscape really impervious, will give us the exact information. It won't be automatically just throwing more land into redevelopment sites than we presently consider to be there.
John, I would like to ask Tom to respond to part of Tracy's comments there.
And this really goes to the issue of whether we are altering the definition and somehow expanding the sites that will be eligible. And by no means do we think we're doing that. The default method is a methodology to allow a essentially like a rebuttable presumption, is that applicants can come in, and we allow for this method to do that, to come in and demonstrate that the sites would meet that 70%. And we are very confident that you could do soil analysis and compaction analysis and show that surfaces do meet that definition. So by no means do we see that we are expanding the number of eligible sites. By no means. What we are doing is creating a methodology to allow the applicant to take a choice. Either they apply the default method, which, as Eileen and Dan and Jim alluded to, is very conservative in terms of the allowance of non-hardscape surfaces, or they can apply the default method, or they can come in with an actual on-site analysis. I don't want to speak for you two, but I think we are actually probably. The default method limits the number of sites that will be eligible, if that's safe to say.
Based on looking at real-life situations on the ground, our expectation is that this method is more conservative than the result you would get if you went out and did a detailed site-specific analysis. And our expectation is that many sites will go with this method anyway, because of the cost savings, and therefore we will wind up with a reduction in the redevelopment area that's designated.
Now, what do you base that on?
Based on actually looking at sites and understanding the development methods that are used on the creation of developed sites. You look at a situation, the slide of Heath is a great example. You know perfectly well that all of those land areas in between the buildings and in between the sidewalks and the buildings have been heavily compacted by equipment, because that's how construction happens. And especially that's how construction 20, 30, 40 years ago happened. So that's the expectation we have, is that once you get off, you know, into the area that you see some trees have been planted and so on, we're not expecting that would ever come up as compacted soils and be eligible. But the areas that are in right in between the buildings and the parking lots and the sidewalks and so on, those have all been subject to a lot of heavy equipment over the years.
Well, just staying on that point for a moment, are you saying that you've looked at the universe of what sites in the Highlands are at this point eligible and meet the redevelopment definition?
No, we have looked at a set of sites, you know, sort of bopped around the Highlands and taken a look at a couple of example sites and gotten a sense of what's out there, but in no way have we done an exhaustive analysis of this.
So that would be casual empiricism.
That would be very time-consuming to do that. We simply do not have time for that at this point.
Yeah. Can you give us an idea of sort of a number? I know when we began early on, we took a look at how many sites in the Highlands would meet the definition of brownfields, for instance, and we found out there's a very limited number. under a dozen, I think, was the number, if I remember right. So,
Contaminated sites?
No, there'd be more. We do have... In the preservation area, I'm sorry.
Oh, and I would say more. Still more. Okay. We do, and that comes directly from DEP, and we do have a map that shows all the brownfields that are designated by DEP within the entire region.
Okay, well, do you have... I mean, just so we can get an idea of how big this issue is.
Of redevelopment sites, no, we have impervious surface mapping of the entire region. That's an exercise the Highlands Council undertook to show actual impervious surface on the ground.
Right, but I'm not talking about that.
I wouldn't say, Tracy, that we have an idea of the number of sites that can...
Well, this is going to apply to brownfields too, right? So,
not the 70%, not this methodology. This just applies to redevelopment, not the brownfields redevelopment.
Oh, it doesn't apply to brownfields.
No.
Brownfields is a separate track, and you get to the same redevelopment area designation, but it has nothing to do with 70% impervious.
That's why this method is absolutely only for this process. No others, not brownfields, definitely not new development.
So, can I just continue on with this thought? Okay, so let's say we use this default method, and a site is found, was it 60, and now... Was it 69 and now is it 70? So it meets the definition now of a redevelopment site.
You're saying the hardscape was 69% and now the total
and
is 70.
And with the default method, now it reaches 70.
Right.
Do you think there's a lot of those in the Highlands?
I couldn't tell you.
I'm just trying to get an idea how big this issue is.
Well, the other implication of the default method, I think, would be there'd be sites that qualify as a redevelopment site, and the default method would mean that the sort of infill pieces of the site, there'd be a little bit more building allowed on it. Is that correct or not?
Well,
or is it just for the definition of whether it's redevelopment?
It's strictly the definition of whether it's a redevelopment site, because the next question is, what waivers would they need from DEP's rules? And DEP will then be looking at what is the minimum amount they need to waive that rule in order to allow for a certain level of redevelopment. So there are a whole series of steps here in the process. The other thing that I would point out is, let's say you have a site that's 70% impervious, and so we designate the site, which is that 70% plus the other 30%. The Highlands Council is not required to allow the designation of that entire area, because if part of it is an environmentally sensitive resource, you actually have the ability to carve that out and say, well, yes, under the 70% plus 30%, you get this, but we're not going to give it to you because it's a stream buffer or something like that. That's all part of the redevelopment designation process. So there are several steps here.
All right. Now, what John asked was going to be the second part of my question. I thought in the example that we used in December that once you then showed how these, you accepted it as a redevelopment site and then showed then how much of the area can be developed, that it did increase based on the increase using the default method of the impervious surface.
The other impervious creates an envelope.
Right.
And if that is larger than the hardscape, then yes, the area that could be designated as a redevelopment site increases proportionally. Then the question is, how much of that are you actually going to allow to be in the redevelopment site, and that's going to be constrained by environmental resources and so on. And then you get to the step of DEP, where they say, how much of the site are they going to allow to actually be redeveloped, and that's a site plan issue. So it's really a three-step process.
Well, I understand the second part of that, but I think the other implication for the council to understand is that, number one, using the method automatically, even though I understand, I think, what Tom's saying, I think, actually, we don't know. We're making a guess, but and it might be correct, an educated guess, that it's not going to increase the number of sites that are available. But let's say that it did, that you're
but
using
I don't think anyone said that, just to be clear. Tracy said they don't know.
Can I just address a point?
They said they thought that it was not going to, and it actually decrease it.
Yes,
that's what they
said.
I don't see this method as increasing the number of sites that are now eligible under the redevelopment criteria for meeting the 70%, because the 70% of the site does not necessarily mean a parcel. The site itself could be what you were designating as the redevelopment area. If an applicant only had, if we only looked at the hardscaped areas, he could still define a 70% redevelopment boundary on that area alone. So it's not as if this method is going to kick a 68% site to a 70%, because he could designate that redevelopment strictly on the hardscape areas, meaning he would just reduce his redevelopment so that the hardscape area is now 70% of a smaller area. So it's not as if more sites will somehow be designated
okay,
as redevelopment.
I see what you're saying. Now, let's say we did that, and they then went through with their application. The second implication that I think that we have to understand here is that then more land can be developed.
Well,
right?
If we're comparing apples to apples.
Yeah.
Apples to apples is you either use the default method or use the site-specific method. And based on that, I cannot draw that conclusion.
Supposing you have a site that's 80% hardscape.
Right. If you're well,
then you just don't use this default method at all because it's already clearly a redevelopment site.
If 80% of the parcel is hardscape, then there's no need to go to this method. You're already above the equation.
That's correct. And so it's not that it then becomes 83%
Because it's you at that point you're dealing with the entire parcel. But let's say you have a 50-acre parcel. And you have development on one portion of it, you define the site, as Jim was saying, as part of that parcel. The rest of the parcel gets deed restricted, and your redevelopment happens within just that redevelopment area. And that's a part of a parcel.
Which is what Heath is.
Right. And that's what Heath is. And so that's where the issue of how big is that envelope comes in, and that's where the use of this default method would come in. And what I'm suggesting is that if you're comparing hardscape to this method would give you somewhat more area. If you're comparing this method to the method of actually doing a site-specific analysis, I cannot make that conclusion.
Okay, I just have a couple other questions, Mr. Chairman. Couple things. TR-55, many engineers, and I've seen in applications for development projects, across the state, that TR-55 can and often does underestimate the amount of runoff produced by a certain land cover. And
what is TR-55 for those of us who don't know off the top of our
heads? It's a stormwater model.
Now, you say you're reducing it then, which, I know there's an Ocean County study that suggests reducing it by one soil group. Mm-hmm. That's what you've done here. Which makes sense to reduce it by a soil group. But you've picked C, sort of, I guess, because it was the next one down from B. It's a little bit arbitrary, it seems. And I would question why we don't go to D, D, which is practically impenetrable, according to your words, why don't we go to, since we're defining it as impervious surface, why don't we go to the runoff coefficient and a volume of runoff that's produced by D, a practically impenetrable surface.
I think at this point, I have to say we're in a public comment period, and I'm going to be very interested in seeing what sort of comments we get from the engineering professionals about that issue, because it's worth considering, but I don't want to precede the close of the comment period. But it's absolutely something that we're going to be looking for comment on.
Well, I would suggest that because I think that it's important for us to be conservative and to realize that since TR-55 in many cases does underestimate the volume of runoff from a certain land cover or a soil group, that we should err on the side of being conservative. And there's no harm in that, and yet there's great benefit in that. So that was one comment I wanted to make.
If I could, I would split that into two questions. One is the use of the soil group and which one we use. The other is that since you're applying the same model to the hardscape and to the non-hardscape surfaces, what we're dealing with is 1% of. It's a relative. So if TR-55 overestimates or underestimates, what you're going to get is that shifts, but they shift in line with each other because it's a 1% of the hardscape area. So that's not as critical as if you were designing a brand new development site, at which point I'd be very concerned about those kinds of things.
It still counts, though. I just like to point out it does count. It's real. And another question
Before you go any further, Mr. Chairman, I apologize, but I have to drop off the phone.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here.
In terms of stormwater, and the calculations that are done for the redevelopment site, then will the applicant count the areas that we have counted as hardscape at, say, the C or the D soil group runoff coefficient when they prepare their stormwater management plan?
When they go to DEP, they will be using stormwater calculations that are based on the DEP rules. And so they should be using the curve numbers that are appropriate to the site as it exists, and then for the site as it will exist, because of course the soils that are there now may not, they may be covered or they may be opened up later on, but it should be a pre and post based on the existing site conditions. And so if they are claiming that the site condition should be a curve number 74 because it's a C soil and it's in lawn, then I would expect that their calculations should show that. And certainly in calculations I've seen as an Environmental Commission member in a non-Highlands town, they do that. They
well,
show that.
So if we are requiring them, my point being that, of course, many times a developer will come in and he will, or she will, say that the runoff is urban, so they don't have to do much stormwater control. And are we aiding that by setting up this default method?
We said, I think we get back to where we said before. The default method only applies for the delineation of the area. Once you're done with that step, you're back into the department's rules, and the department will define exactly how you're supposed to do that. So the assumptions we make for the default method are in many ways irrelevant to the regulatory process for new development.
Okay, well, I think that's good. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I mean, every engineer, when he's developing a stormwater management plan, needs to base his professional judgment to see what the actual runoff is. I mean, that's, I think, imperative in any design, because he has to then, with the DEP rules, then meet certain quantity reductions and water quality criteria. So the stormwater management design, it's a bit independent of this method, because he's trying to actually mimic how much runoff, how soon it will occur. And this particular method only looks at the runoff volume, which is a little bit different than runoff rate, which is actually what stormwater management gets to.
Well, it gets to volume, too.
Yes. And now there's recharge requirements that DEP has. But when he sizes detention basins and pipes and things like that, there's a lot of other things that come into play. For example, how quickly the runoff drains the site and that type of thing, which this really doesn't get into. So there's a lot of other considerations in the stormwater management that an engineer will look at that this really doesn't try to address.
Right. It just seems like we could very easily be muddying the waters here quite a bit, because it's going to be confusing. And aren't we going to be, for instance, they'll probably be doing their in situ test anyway, right, in order to do their runoff count. Or if they're not, aren't we setting up a double-tiered system here where they're counting for us in one way and they're counting for D? How are we going to make this clear? And I don't think the memo makes that very clear. That we put out there. I think we need to make that much clearer. A couple other things based on the memo.
Well, Tracy, we are going to talk about this again.
I know, but I wanted to get a couple other questions because the comment period is ending. How many days did this go out for public comment? And I'm worried about this being rushed. I think this is a really important issue.
It was a 30-day
process. 30-day comment period.
Okay. I would suggest that we open it up for another 30 days. I don't know what the hurry is. We don't need to, what is the rush here. I think this needs very careful consideration.
To and my knowledge, we have not received any requests from the public for an extension of the comment period.
All right. Well, I'm suggesting that as a council member. And then the other question I had is this, what is this? Is this a rule? Is it going to be part of the plan? I mean, how?
Good question.
Part of the redevelopment procedures that we set forth, that we already put out for public comment earlier. Tracy, and what we were going to do is come back to you, because we've taken comment on those, and this would be part of those procedures, because it will be part of the process that an applicant goes through in order to get that redesignation. So it's part of our procedures.
I think there is a little confusion about what this actually is and how this dovetails with the plan, because people may comment on the plan and yet there are procedures and other rules outside the plan that are very important in terms of how the plan's going to work.
And this was something, I think, as Tim said, and you part of this, I think the Natural Resources Committee felt it would be good to get public input on this before the full council considered it. It's not a rule. There's no, there was no formal requirement for the public hearing, for the public comment period.
Right.
But where will it fit into? Up to Tracy's question.
This is not a modification to the regional master plan. This is a procedure that would be adopted by the council to guide how its future deliberations and its interaction with these applicants would occur. So this is just like...
Will there be a reference to that in the plan?
Well, there already is. In the plan, it calls for redevelopment areas procedures. And so, so we have that in there. So this is no different from the water quality management plan amendment review procedures or the scenic resource designation procedures. Very much the same sort of document.
So if a developer wants to understand how they should move forward on this, it'll be on the website?
Oh, absolutely.
Procedures?
Yes.
I mean,
it'll be under our procedures, and there'll be separate procedures for the different processes that you go through, and all of those will be laid out in a very public way. And in order to arrive at those procedures, we're going through this very public process as well, and we've done it in each of the cases. In fact, you know, we've got the scenic resources, those procedures are ready to come back to you. They go through the Natural Resources Committee and then to the council. But that is exactly how it'll be. It'll be fully available on the website.
Okay. So we're not done with this. It'll be coming back to us.
Right. Oh, yes. Right.
The intent, that's why I prefaced this at the outset by saying the public comment period closes currently March 3rd, at which point it will be coming back to the council to make its determinations.
I have a question about this. Can we go back to the slide that it's the zoom-in slide of this site?
Where we have a zoom-in.
Oh, I think it was the second example.
The other example, whatever it was. There was one that was...
Of the industrial site.
That one.
This is Borealis.
Okay, so this is Borealis?
Yes.
Okay, so the yellow are the areas that we're talking about, if I recall correctly. These are where the default would apply.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this particular... And I'm speaking as somebody with a total non-technical background in this, so just practically speaking. When I look at that and I listen to what the description of the default method is, practically speaking, common sense tells me grassy areas in the middle of all this hardscape, it's really not a big issue. It's impervious to a practical extent. So the default method makes sense. But what if those yellow areas were to the... outside of all those hardscape areas? What is there in this, in which it isn't such a no-brainer, to use my terminology, what in this default method controls, for lack of a better word, that the default method no longer would really be a sound application here?
This is what Jim mentioned earlier. It has to be contiguous to the hardscape. You can't have it over there because that would be completely irrelevant. And it must be within the same drainage area. So you can't have a situation where you have a berm, for instance, and the one side of the berm drains away and the other side of the berm drains toward the hardscape. That area on the other side of the berm that drains away from the hardscape, out. It cannot be included. And that's even if you don't get full credit under this method. If you only get half of it within the same drainage area and contiguous, that's all you get.
I think Jim didn't say contiguous, though. He just said adjacent. Contiguous is better, because contiguous, I think, is...
To us, adjacent to hardscape and contiguous to hardscape are the same thing.
So it can't be this. It can't be that woods over here.
Absolutely.
Now, we said wood, and I'm distinguishing between woods, which is natural.
And it has to be a continuously disturbed surface. It cannot be natural vegetation.
And I've been to the site, so I can address a little bit more of the resources. So some of those areas in the bottom corner that are in scrub, those are now reverting to natural vegetation. So we would not consider those as being part of these areas. The area, that big field to the upper part, that's actually something that they have leased out to agricultural. And there's other resources that we have to apply. We have agricultural resource protection standards. That will have to be addressed there. And we would say, well... obviously, with our protective standards, that would not be included for redevelopment under this.
And to explain why I'm asking the questions, I certainly have no reason I'm not familiar with these sites. I'm not familiar with the issue with Borealis. I'm certainly not looking to restrict their potential for redevelopment, but those of us who've sat on this side of the table in land use boards, we inadvertently create loopholes sometimes, and it's a fairness issue, and that's why I'm asking these questions.
And I think, Debbie, if I could just elaborate a little more on the response as well, is that you don't automatically go to the 1%. That is the maximum. And I think that when I was listening to your question, I was sort of trying to see what you were saying and saying, well, if all of that was hardscape, including the yellow, could you then start going out into the field, for example? And the answer is no.
Not because of the 1%. The 1% is part of the restriction.
The 1% is the cap, but you don't automatically go there. And then, beyond that, there's the other considerations that they were talking about, that it has to be disturbed, compacted, et cetera. It's not sort of just...
So let's use an example where there's, 20 acres of lawn. It might be an extreme example, 10 acres. And it's not a drainage issue, as you described. There's no berm, whatever. Mm-hmm. Would the extent of that eligibility for redevelopment be restricted by the 1% rule?
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. You don't get the whole lawn. And, yes, I have seen 20-acre lawns at industrial facilities.
We've seen them.
And you don't get it. You don't get that whole area.
It's the hardscape that's the 1% will be based on. So lawns by itself are not hardscape. They will not generate their own impervious cover for the purpose of 70%. It's really the hardscape is the trigger for the 1%.
Got it.
I think this is very helpful, but I think we should move on because we're going to discuss this in more detail. What's out
Mr.
there?
Chairman, can I just ask a simple question?
If you know what about this subject.
This has nothing to do with all of these calculations. But we keep referring to a site.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And so at some point in time, I'm going to want somebody to tell me exactly what is a site. It's not a lot and block number, right?
Absolutely not.
So...
I think Jim got to that best in his response. So, but if you want to clarify, Jim, because you were the one who brought that.
It's very complicated.
It doesn't have to be that complicated. At the maximum, absolute maximum, it's the property that they own. They can't have a redevelopment site that spills off into somebody else's property. And at a minimum, it's the area that is defined within the property that meets the requirements of the Act. So it's the 70% impervious plus another 30% minus any environmentally restricted land. So it can be part of a parcel. It can be a whole parcel. If they own two side-by-side parcels and there are buildings on both, it could be both of those parcels. But there's a limit based on ownership first and then site-specific conditions second.
Wouldn't there also be a consideration for whether or not the applicant wants to redevelop?
If they don't come to us, we never know about them.
And maybe you designate that site. It will be your ultimate decision. It's the Highlands Council. You, the Highlands Council, because if you look at the project here and you imagine that you draw the line then that says, okay, and here's where the other 30% is, that then is the site. If you've taken out those resources, whatever, that is the site. So you designate the site. That's what the Act calls for.
But if this landowner owned 500 acres of farmland going up off the top of the map, mm-hmm. their site, they would not get to 70% of it if one considered that entire area their site.
That's correct.
That's why we look at the impervious surface in existence and you draw the redevelopment area around that. That's why you don't get multiple sites by looking at these calculations.
I don't understand how
that relates. What are you saying now?
If this impervious surface, in this case here, let's just say it is one-tenth of the entire block and lot, it can still be, it is 70% of the site that you designate as the redevelopment area.
Who is me?
The council.
The council makes the designation, but yes, if they had 100 acres and they had 10 acres of hardscape, they might get another, based on these calculations, 1 acre, so they get 11 acres. And so what happens to the rest of the area? Under the DEP rules, the rest of the area, the rest of the property, the parcel, becomes deed restricted. And that's it.
But now you're lot and block.
The parcel is the lot and block. The site is a parcel. It would, in that case, be a part of a lot and block. So the redevelopment site can be a portion of a parcel, At most, it can be a full parcel, you know, the full ownership area. But it can be part of a parcel, and the rest of the parcel gets deed restricted and never gets developed from then on.
What if somebody owns two pieces, and this is developed, and he right. wants that to be considered a redevelopment area? This has never been developed, but he wants to do something with that sometime. But he doesn't, for the redevelopment, you know, criteria, he doesn't want the whole area taken into account. He just wants the one lot and block considered.
We're going to look at the undeveloped portion. If it goes back to Dan's point about that ownership, that applicant is submitting it for those two parcels, we have a maximum we're allowed to approve, which is the 70%.
But maybe he's only submitting one of them.
Part,
even though
part,
we know he owns that other one.
Part of the procedures we put out for public comment go to the ownership issues and build the ownership into the procedures.
Heath is a good example where they own other lots that are contiguous, and they are contiguous. They're also adjacent. and they are going to wind up being deed restricted because these are lots in common ownership. And so in the case of Heath, they have agreed that they will deed restrict those other lots. Now, frankly, they wouldn't have gotten much development out of those lots anyway, but the fact is they're going to be deed restricting those lots.
We want to encourage redevelopment.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question about the public comment period.
Is yours simple, too? Oh, go
ahead. It is simple. On the public comment period, unless you were really watching our website, you wouldn't have known that this went up for public comment.
Well, some people put out a press release within minutes of the comment.
Well, I think, you know, the general public, there was no press release that we put out to say, hey, these procedures are going up, you know, you have 30 days to look at them. So I really would like to suggest, and I don't think we voted as a council that it be a 30-day comment period, I don't see the harm in us extending the public comment on this for, you know, another 15, 30 days, I would say 30 days, in order to allow people to take a look. Because now we've had a full council discussion on this. It's the first time we've done that, and the public now knows about it and can comment. Some people are probably finding out about it for the first time today. I would just like to suggest that we consider, I don't think we need a vote, we don't have a quorum anyway, but I would suggest that we just perhaps agree that we extend the public comment.
And a larger issue is if we have a comment period out there, we should be doing a press release. We should be doing something to put it out there, you know, unrelated to the specifics of this issue. I'm uncomfortable now that I'm hearing that.
Well, let me just tell you what you've been in the practice of doing at the Natural Resource Committee meetings. We've done this before when it came to like the redevelopment procedures, where the Natural Resources Committee says, yes, you can put these up for public comment. Then when the public comment period is closed, they can either go back to NRC or straight to the council. That is because it is at a public meeting, an NRC meeting, and it is, you know, we did discuss it at that meeting, and that's when we said we put it up for public comment. And there was a delay in the case of that because the committee members wanted to have some further input. But I will tell you that members of the public were contacting us, particularly those that were involved, like Heath, saying to us, you said you'd bring it to the council. When are you bringing it to the public? I mean, they were very eager to move this on. I'm only bringing this to your attention because they have concerns that we keep this moving. My major concern is to keep all the work progressing because you're going to hit a time when you're considering regional master plan adoption as well.
Well, let me just ask, how many people here in the public are hearing,
yes,
were unaware that we had a proposal on this issue on the website? The right side knew and left
side. Mr. Chairman, we did issue a public notice on February 4th, and we noticed in that notice that public comments are due by March 3rd. And have we received an awful lot of public comments on this, Dan?
You not to know.
No.
In general, we received them the day of.
Yeah. How was that formal notice done that Jack referred to? How was it distributed?
We put it on our website. And we have Hot Topics. We put it on our website.
That's not adequate. I mean, it costs us nothing to do a fax.
Well, let's do this. We're meeting again on February. We're meeting again next Thursday. As Tracy pointed out, we don't have a quorum at this point anyway. So let's see next week what volume of public comments we've received and if we think it's necessary to do more or not, do a more extensive public comment period or a longer public comment period. And I'd like to...
I've got a more procedural question. Are we subject to procedural rules like other departments in the state that we have to publish in the state register, I think it is?
So actually, what we do in for our master plan and for procedures going afterwards is we have a separate set of procedures we have to comply with, which is the master plan, the public hearings we did, and the process to submit our plan to the governor. We are required to do procedural rules for when we do fees, so we do fees in the future. But no, the framework is a master plan through the public hearings, and then the procedures as they get codified will get codified in municipal and county ordinances and county master plans and municipal master plans. So there is ongoing procedures for full implementation of the plan.
But the only thing then that we're going to publish in the state register is going to be anything related to fees.
Yes, and to the extent the council wants to do any other rules, it should find necessary. But that's the only one we're mandated.
But a rule, not a procedure.
Correct.
The procedures we're following for public involvement are essentially the same and in many cases more extensive than would be if the case was a rule, but it's a different process.
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to move to the committee reports. Personnel committee met. You all received a summary of that report of that committee meeting. Any questions about it? We talked about trying to fill the vacancies on the council staff as quickly as possible. The audit evaluation committee met in the Meadowlands so we could accommodate the public interest in that committee. Tracy, you chair that?
Yes, the audit evaluation committee met on January 24th. Our financial consultant has completed the analysis of our finances, which were done since the inception, back to the inception of the council. And according to an executive order, we're required to engage an independent auditor to audit our records, our financial records. So we put out an RFP. It was published. It was also sent out to all state registered auditors. And that has already gone out. I think it's due today or tomorrow. The RFPs are responses are due back. And then the Audit Evaluation Committee will make a recommendation to the Audit Committee of the responses that we receive. And then that committee will move forward with naming an auditor and have our audit completed.
I have a question. When was that executive order issued?
I can look it up for you. I don't have it offhand.
Recently?
No, some time ago.
Has it taken us years to get to that determination that there was an executive order? We've been told many times that there wasn't one requiring an audit, so I'd like to know what the date is.
Wasn't it the order that led us to create these committees?
Yes.
And it was, we created two audit-related committees.
Well, as the former treasurer, I was told many times by staff that an audit was not required. And if you look back at reports, so I'd like to know when that is.
But I remember when you couldn't be on the audit, or when we had a discussion about you being on the audit.
Set that up, but then we wanted to do that for our own.
No, we were mandated to do, because we set up two audit committees, which I've never fully understood why, but the order said we had to.
The order says that.
Yeah. But we didn't get to that. Natural Resource Committee, we have the summaries of two Natural Resource Committee meetings in our packets. Tim's gone. I don't know if anyone has any questions about those reports, or Tracy or Kurt want to add anything. Okay. Any other comments before we go to public comments? Okay. Is there anybody from the public who would like to speak?
I brought my gang with me.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Freeholder Sharp, for inviting me to speak to the council. My name is Mike Stoddard. I'm the president of the Mid-Atlantic Aviation Coalition. I sent you a letter, and it was dated February 19th, and it concerned the inclusion of airports in your draft. My initial reaction was that welcome to the world of NIMBYs, bananas, you know who they are, and a new designation called CAVES, Citizens Against Virtually Everything.
You're leaving out NOPE.
Yes. Personally, I'd like to thank all of you for the job that you have undertaken. I've been on that side of the table and have been subjected to many of the remarks and, of course, congratulations. But right now, I think you're in an area where you don't belong. I think airports are not your concern. And for that, I give you Mr. Parker, who happens to be the owner of an airport. And with that...
Hi. My name is Steve Parker, and my family owns and operates Somerset Airport. The company we run is called Somerset Air Service. We're in at George Walker Field in Bedminster, New Jersey. Right? Bedminster, of course, is half protection zone and half planning, or protection area, half planning area. Anyway, I want to speak on behalf of my family's airport, but I think some of my comments you may be able to interpret them for some of the other airports that are within the Highlands region. The classification of our airport in specifically, which is Block 61, Lot 6 in Bedminster Township, we've been classified as a protection zone in the latest RMP. And that doesn't really, in my opinion, it isn't indicative of what is actually on the property, and I would hope that it would be considered for revision. I believe looking at the RMP and how you classify the land, the existing community is what we would be more aptly considered. Based upon the existing infrastructure on the airfield, similar to some of the discussions you've already had on redevelopment areas. Also, the classification of similar properties, similar airports within the Highlands zone, and also the population density within the surrounding community. And I'll let you know that we are on the very southern tip of the Highlands region. I mean, we can throw a rock from our property and hit Bridgewater, which is not within the Highlands. Talking about existing infrastructure, our property is 200 acres. We've got three runways, parallel taxiways, ramps, driveways, you know, probably a little more than 1.9 million square feet of what you were all just talking about, impervious surface of some point. We've got more than 18 buildings, 170 aircraft on the field, commercial-grade electric, telephone, internet service. We just put a brand-new septic system in just about a year and a half ago, all in compliance with DEP standards, went through tremendous scrutiny through the town. And as an airport, compared to a lot of other usage, we don't use a lot of water. We have no means to irrigate. We've got a total of three lavatories on the whole property. So I know the main thrust of this body here is to protect water, and we really don't use very much water. Talking about similar properties, Morristown and Hackettstown Airport, as I went on your website and looked through the interactive map, and that interactive map is pretty neat. I don't know who put that together, but it's a tremendous tool.
I did.
Well, there you go. Very good, sir.
And Albert made the internet.
Right. There you go. But taking two airports in specific, Morristown and Hackettstown, one is substantially larger than our airport and more... That would be Morristown. And Hackettstown, which is actually much smaller than our facility. And yet both of those are considered existing community. And I've got a little package I'd be happy to pass around. It just shows some of the pictures so you can get an idea of what I'm talking about. If you look at the way the map was coded around Morristown Airport, you can see Whippany and the city of Morristown and the various... neighborhoods surrounding Morristown, they're obviously existing community because they're densely populated, heavily developed tracts of land. And the airport itself, where the runways and the hard surface is existing community. But you can also see that there's wetlands and there's open fields surrounding the airport infrastructure, and that's coded green protection zone. So obviously, when you all looked at that, you know, looked at it pretty carefully, I believe, to determine what was developed and what was not developed and what could be classified for protection. Hackettstown Airport, again, a little smaller airport. I believe they've only got one small paved runway. And they're surrounded on either side by what was classified on the map as state game farm. And there's rural areas to the northwest of their property. They've also got a subdivision to the east and to the west in Beattystown, just to the south, the little hamlet. But yet, that property was coded existing community. Our entire property at Somerset Airport was coded protection zone. We abut the Raritan River out to the west, and in fact, we've even got with the township a conservation easement in that direction. There is the Snorowski Farm, which Somerset County has subsequently either purchased or purchased the rights to. I think that's considered county-owned parkland, or will be turned over. And then to the east, we've got Bridgewater, obviously outside the Highlands region, but that's, you know, quarter and half acre lots, a lot of subdivisions there.
Mr. Parker, sorry, excuse me for interrupting. We normally try to limit speakers to 3 minutes. Since there are three of you, I think the chairman is going to give you 9 minutes. Is that correct? But, and I know you have a
I can give you the text of this and try to bring this to a...
That'd be great. I have one question I had is whether you're planning, you have plans to expand the airport or develop, because your existing operations are unaffected by what the Highlands plan says.
I understand. The new the State Division of Aeronautics just put out the New Jersey State Airport Master or State Airport Plan, and we have a master plan for the airport. That airport systems plan has us coded for runway improvements and taxiway improvements and light improvements. We're expected 17% growth through 2020. Those things are all about, you know, they're just like any other commercial operation. Yeah, we would expect to improve as the years go on. Airports, as a matter of fact, in the state of New Jersey, I mean, we had 82 in 1950, and we're down to about 45 today. We lose about one every 18 to 24 months. Also, we're privately owned, which most people don't associate with an airport. They think a municipal airport. And so that means we've got really the mom-and-pop economic model. We're pretty much like, we're similar to Mr. Alstead's farm in that we're a land-rich operation. So if we got to go get a new airplane or a new roof on the hangar, we've got to go down to the bank and, well, what's your collateral? Well, it's my 200 acres here in Bedminster. So as a preservation zone, that really erodes into our opportunity to privately improve ourselves. And... anyway, the short answer is I would just ask that you look at how these properties are coded and maybe take another look at our property. And I'm going to turn you over to Mr. Bill Levins, New Jersey Aviation.
Yeah, I'm Bill Levins with the New Jersey Aviation Association. A couple of quick things. First of all, New Jersey, as you may know, is twice as densely populated as India. The second thing, about 2%, or 0.2% of all the people in the state are pilots. So we are significantly outnumbered, and the opponents to airports are legendary. Previously, thanks to Mr. Schreier, language was taken out of the draft RMP, which referred to quality of life issues around airports, and I thank you for that. The draft RMP also identified three airports in the Highlands area. There's in fact six, and they're coded as all three categories, as preservation, as planning, and as conservation areas. Ms. Swan came and talked to my planning board last night. Thank you very much. It was a very enlightening discussion. And one of the things that I learned was that public transportation facilities are to be classified as existing communities. Also, in Mr. Parker's case, they have a medevac operation down there. Health and public safety operations are to receive exemptions from Highlands regulations. And I just want to emphasize that airports, by and large, serve the public good. They generate or are responsible for about $4 billion in economic activity. That's at the latest measure. And what we'd like you to do is to clarify the significance of airports as contributors to the public welfare and safety and recognize them as the economic engines that they are and classify them as existing communities. And that's all I'll say. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Thank you.
Before we leave, I'd like to make one more comment. 50 years ago, if I may, I sat at a meeting just like this over at Lake Apatcon. At the time, we were trying to figure out how to get water out of Lake Apatcon, over the mountain, into the Rockaway River to feed the people down there. So thank you. I just want you to know that droughts are part of the picture, too. Thank you.
Other comments?
Again, John Millay, Raritan Highlands Compact. I'd like to get some, hopefully get some clarification from Eileen as to the status of your ongoing discussions with COA. It seems that municipality...
This is not the time for a question and answer session.
Okay, well, let me just put this on the record then. And I'm going to say that I'm going to hope that the discussions are ongoing and substantive fairly quickly. It seems that the municipalities of New Jersey have a crisis du jour, whether it's school funding or whether it's this organization or whatever. The crisis du jour right now appears to be the new COA rules. I attended a seminar in Somerset County just a couple of weeks ago. That was the speaker was Lucy Verhoeve, who was the head of that. And it seems to me that based on her description of the growth share quotas and all of that, they have not taken into consideration much of anything having to do with this group, certainly nothing to do with the State Planning Commission. They've assigned all sorts of growth shares to towns that are in planning areas 4 and 5. They don't appear to have taken into consideration infrastructure limitations, all of the things that Eileen talked about earlier in her executive report. So I'm hoping that the meetings that this group has with COA can do something to resolve that issue, because it seems to me at this point there's a fairly significant disconnect between the goals and objectives of COA, their goal of 100,000 new units, and the goals and objectives of this group.
Thank you. Any comments?
And my time might be running out, so.
We hear from an endangered species.
That's right. Good afternoon, Monique Purcell, Department of Agriculture.
Yes, now.
Hopefully in the future. Just a couple comments. The department will be submitting, obviously, formal comments to the council later on today, probably by midnight, if that counts.
Yes.
Obviously, we're very, we support a lot of the changes that have happened in the plan, this version. The clustering provisions are, we feel, very critical. I actually think that's the best part of the plan, is the cluster section under programs. I think it's very well written. I think it talks about all the different scenarios and when about clustering and what the ultimate goals are. And I would hope that since Eileen mentioned in her report that that's going to be reexamined, that that would then be brought back before plan adoption, because I think it's important that we have another discussion in case there's going to be significant changes to that section. Other areas that we are very concerned about, obviously TDR, we feel that that section has been very well developed under the landowner fairness section. We think it's critical that landowners will be able to actually calculate their credits upon plan adoption. Obviously, now we need to fund the bank, and that's no news to anyone. We continue to urge the council to petition the legislature to identify a dedicated funding source for land acquisition in the Highlands. That's not news to anyone. And finally, we do think we're a significant part of this process. I mean, that's why either I've been here or a staff member has been to just about every Highlands Council meeting. public hearing and the whole way down the road. We feel there's a lot of work ahead for plan conformance. We are fully committed to be engaged in that process. Hopefully we'll be able to weather the storm and continue to be an agency that can contribute to that. And we ask for any support that you could provide, as Kurt mentioned earlier. Thank you.
Thank you.
Julia Summers, New Jersey Highlands Coalition, also known as Marie Antoinette. Just two things. First of all, I don't know if I have to put it in writing, but if I have to put it in writing, I would be happy to do so. We would like to formally request an extension of the public comment period on the impervious cover process.
You did not deal with this issue on the 150 pages you submitted?
Well, this is not in the RMP.
I know, but I'm just asking.
Did so, you, no, we did
but,
not.
But you did refer to it in the summary, I noticed. That's the
yes, I did. Okay, I did. But it is not in the RMP. We will submit okay. separate comments okay. Before whatever the deadline okay. is. And my other is just a question I want you to consider, which is the process that you've been going through to consider the issue of impervious coverage. How does that become part of the RMP? Does it become part of the RMP?
Thanks.
Thank you.
We did just discuss that, I think. It's a procedure. The process is the council would vote to approve this as a procedure that would be on, that would be one of the procedures that the council would use to implement the RMP.
One of a great many.
David Shope. I have a farm in Lebanon Township. First, on the impervious coverage exercise that we just went through today, what you're really saying is to people is go away. No one's going to go through the exercise that you just proposed unless it's one of out of absolute desperation, and certainly no new people will come here. It's the beginning of the end of any kind of economic growth in the Highlands area. I think the airports contribute more to the area in terms of contributions to the economy than ecotourism does. Also, I was distressed to hear that Governor Corzine is proposing cutting the Department of Agriculture. All 50 states, Guam, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, and American Samoa all have departments of agriculture. Rhode Island has lumped it in with DEP, or their equivalent of DEP. Rhode Island is 1/7 the population and 1/7 the land area. Alaska has lumped it in with natural resources, fisheries, mining, and that sort of stuff. So this is, quite frankly, I found this just another exhibition of the total cynicism of this act and of this state's quote support of agriculture unquote. It's ludicrous. And I will leave with you a copy of all 50, should you wish to call them up. And I want to thank you for actually providing me with an ideal condo site on my rocky hillside, because hillsides don't collect water. Water runs off. Rocks don't collect water. Water runs off. So I will go out and start to measure the rocks now and calculate the drainage on the steep hillside to show you that my land does not contribute to groundwater absorption. Thank you. Thank you. One other thing. I'd like to apply right now for my TDR sign-up program. How do I do that?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
We have a TDR program. I'd like to sign up for it.
To be a receiving area? I want to get a receiving area for my condos on my hillside. You do it through your municipality.
Ask them to rescind their steep slope ordinance for us.
Well, it doesn't apply, obviously. Not for water conservation.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Afternoon.
Dennis Topf from of Wolf and Sampson representing Pinnacle Communities. One of the projects discussed in the report from the Natural Resources Committee, I just wanted to note for the record, we have submitted the additional information discussed in that report, along with a letter pointing out, most importantly, that as an exempt project, the Pinnacle project is not subject to your rules or procedures. The exemption is very broad in the statute. It says we are exempt from the DEP Islands rules, we are exempt from the regional master plan, and we're exempt from your processes. So our main concern is that the council and its staff seems to be comparing the project to regional master plan requirements that simply don't apply. So we ask that you fully consider our position as submitted in the letter. We look forward to having a further dialogue with your staff about that as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Ellen Heinrich speaking as usual for the New Jersey Farm Bureau. A lot of what I could say has already been said probably better by other people, but we are sending our comments in, and I was interested to see you got some, I guess, from the Highlands Coalition for 150 pages. Ours is only half that big, so I'm wondering if we missed something.
About 3 hours, Ellen.
You use larger type.
Right.
Small type.
Support for the NJDA is essential. But all throughout our comments, we applauded the changes in the plan that encouraged or required more and more cooperation, coordination, and so forth with them as you're dealing with agriculture. But NJDA has the experience and the knowledge to do that. And it's just a nightmare to think that we'd have to go to two or three agencies to get that kind of expertise. So I guess I hope that you do that analysis that Kurt asked you for and come up with some support. I think it would mean a lot, certainly mean a lot to the farm community. Hopefully the governor would listen to you. Another analysis I wonder if you could make is to take a look at all the budget submissions. And we are very disappointed in that there wasn't very much in there for this land acquisition funding situation that we are in, which is so important to other people. I hear today that you have an additional $12 million in it for grants to towns. And over the farmers say, you got money for everybody except the landowners in this situation. So could you take analyze the budget to see if there's any relief for this or any creative ways that through somebody else's program begin to compensate some of the landowners that are caught in this whole thing? I also agree with Monique that when you do your cluster revisions, I hope that would come before the council again for a full discussion or a committee before you would adopt it. Would come up again. Good. And the last thing is, as far as COA, just listening at the State Planning Commission, it sounds like they decided to do the towns a favor by imposing the ability to charge an impact fee on commercial development. And I immediately thought, how on earth are we ever going to get developers interested in a receiving area, mixed use, which both state plan and your plan favor, if they get hit with an impact fee for the residences, they also get hit with an impact fee for anything else that they do. And is this going to diminish the interest in participating in if we ever do get a receiving area set up? So I'd be interested in, you said your comments will be presented next week for the COA?
Our comments on the COA rules will be discussed next week.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, long morning for you guys. Just with regard to Pinnacle.
Can you just say who you are? Sorry.
Yes, certainly. Betsy Stagg, Councilwoman Borough of Oakland, but I'm speaking as a private resident in Oakland. On behalf of many constituents and friends in Oakland, I would like to just say with regard to Pinnacle that we certainly hope that the council upholds the recommendations of your Natural Resources Committee in making your recommendations and letters to NJDEP. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is David Oberlander. I'm the firm Flaster Greenberg. We represent Bi-County Development of Oakland, which is the owner of the property on which Pinnacle is proposing to construct its inclusionary housing development. And I just wanted to emphasize one or two aspects of that project. Primarily, this is an inclusionary development which will provide a very substantial amount of affordable housing. The project itself arose out of a Mount Laurel lawsuit which was filed against the borough of Oakland in the late 80s. The project's been actively planned since that time. It's undergone a long and torturous review process before many state agencies. It's been approved on several occasions by the Superior Court of New Jersey, both in the context of affordable housing requirements and in the context of sewer requirements. It was approved after a very lengthy hearing by the Oakland Planning Board. It has received numerous DEP approvals, each of which has required some form of rigorous analysis. Most significantly, this project has the endorsement of the state legislature in the act which created this council. The legislature also inserted an exemption for a project just like this that was the subject of a Mount Laurel settlement agreement. It showed its support essentially by divesting you of jurisdiction, as Mr. Toff said earlier. It is clearly the policy of the state of New Jersey that this affordable housing project be built. It is clearly the policy of your Highlands Act, by virtue of that exemption, that this affordable housing be built. Under a recent case by the courts involving the regulations of the Maryland's Development Commission, it is clear that state agencies, such as the Highlands Council, have an obligation to facilitate the production of affordable housing. And I would request that the council members look carefully at this and not impose themselves as a barrier to the development of highly needed affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Buffcock, Sewer Township. Glad to hear the mapping with the little TDR credits is available, because that's just in time. I came across some minutes from the Highlands, not from the Oxford Township meeting of over a year ago, and we were promised that by Jeff LaJava last November. So it's good to see it's happening, and as long as all that information is available and we know how to do the credits, I too would like to ask for an application for determination of how many credits I have, as long as it's ready and available. That brings me to the most distressing part of this week. I don't think I can be as nice as everybody else about what happened with the budget process this week, so I'll try and read from it, and that'll control my profanity. But this council's charged with the protection of the resources and economic vitality of the Highlands, and you've received a lot of criticism from both sides of the aisle that you haven't effectively advocated for these protections. We've repeatedly asked for the council to meet with the governor and the legislature to seek support to achieve these goals through changes in the legislation, implementation of funding mechanisms, and development of MOAs with other agencies. The council has repeatedly refused to do this. This week, the results of that inaction should now be crystal clear to all of us. The governor has recommended disbanding the Department of Agriculture. This department is not important to him. This is no big surprise, since not even the Highlands Council, who's responsible for protecting agriculture in the Highlands, ever bothered to communicate the importance of agriculture, farmers, or the infrastructure and advocacy for farmers that the Department of Agriculture provides. Quite the opposite. Not only did the Highlands Council fail to communicate these things, it produced a plan that advocates protection of the dirt beyond everything else. Warren County is the only county, is the county that's the most impacted by the Highlands Act. We've repeatedly asked you to obey the legislative mandate to protect and promote the economic vitality of the area. Again, not one action has been taken by the council to do this. And again, the issue is of little importance to the governor as a result. So not only is Warren County struggling with the same issues as counties across the state, but it's now faced with a mind-boggling loss of municipal aid. 98% of our towns, all but one of our towns, will lose 50 to 100% of their aid. 55% of our towns will lose every single dime. Yes, the taxes we pay, not one red cent will come back to the majority of the towns in Warren County. Plus, all agreements with the state for police coverage are null and void. This comes on the heels of the state refusing to do things like pick up deer carcasses just last year. These things are a huge percentage of our budgets. Allowing an entire county to figure out how to survive with a 75% reduction in state funds and find a way to cope with the economic devastation caused by the Highlands Act could never have happened if the Highlands Council had been honest and open with their own boss. This continued fecklessness of the council has gone beyond irresponsible and is deeply unethical. You should meet with the governor and appropriate members of the legislature immediately if you intend to protect the Highlands. If you don't, Warren County may end up being the financial straw that breaks New Jersey's back. There's nothing more for the state to take. It took half the assets of the county away with the Highlands Act. Now it's taking every single dime away from most of our townships. What happens when a government takes everything away from its citizens? We'll soon find out, but if history is any indication, insurrection and armed rebellion have been the answer.
Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. Regarding the Pinnacle development, I would just like to say that the council members should feel confident in sending their staff report to the DEP that was endorsed by the Natural Resources Committee. This report was accurate, and it's an excellent report. This development was one of the most egregious proposals in the Highlands, as I stated at the Natural Resources Committee meeting. The Highlands Coalition made a list of about 40 developments when the Highlands Act was coming into being, and this was the only one in Bergen County, and it is a violation of practically every DEP rule that exists. It is just, and to assert that this is a substantial contribution to affordable housing is inaccurate. I think that you should not be swayed by that recent comment.
Can you say why that's inaccurate?
Pardon me?
Why is that inaccurate?
Well, I believe that it's 13% affordable from the numbers that I have. It's a very small proportion. And it's one of these cases where if the development itself had been under the COA rules rather than simply a builder's remedy lawsuit, it never would have been put here, because COA rules actually require that a development respect environmental sensitivities. They also talk about the development being in planning 1, 2, and 3, and not in 4 and 5, and a majority of this site is in planning area 5. So it does not really meet the requirements. Regarding the impervious cover issue that we heard discussed today, I too would like, I think that an extension of public comment period would be appropriate. I think there are a lot of questions, even though I disagreed with some folks who said this would result in the development of 25% of the preservation area. I think that there are definitely concerns. Number one, I question whether the legislature itself had in mind anything other than hardscape when it put the definition into the act, whether it was thinking of people probing the soil to find out whether it was pervious or not pervious. I think that they probably were thinking of what they listed primarily. The other thing is there are a lot of components in this model that are not clear to people. there are questions about this TR 55 stormwater rule and how it actually reflects to reality. There are questions about the soil type that the model was applied to. It's been suggested that it perhaps should be applied to soil type D rather than soil type C. So there's a lot of underlying detailed analysis going on there that has not really been explored by either the public or, and it has not been applied to a range of different kinds of sites. I mean, it seems to me that this is being pushed by a specific developer, a specific redevelopment proposal. And in connection with that Heath proposal, I would like to see on these drawings that are presented, not just the showing where the impervious cover exists and where this the extension of the impervious cover is, but what impact does that have on the redevelopment envelope? On none of these drawings do we see the line of, if the impervious is 70%, where is the 100%? We do not see how that is affecting the entire site, and what would be the difference between just using the hardscape and using the hardscape with the addition, on a site basis. It could affect very small residential lots, and it seems like there needs to be more of a range of situations looked at and analyzed by the staff before this methodology is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elliot Rubin, New Jersey Highlands Coalition, and I have concerns of possible loopholes and unintended consequences of the default method to determine redevelopment areas, since impervious cover is primarily used in the determination, and compacted soils and disturbed soils are given equal weight. There's nothing in the methodology that says that there even needs to be any hardscape present at all. So I'm wondering now if golf courses or fallow farm fields can be redevelopment sites. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other
comments?
We don't have enough votes to adjourn, so we're here forever.
we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
All right. Have a second? Okay, well, we'll gather again next week. Thank you all.
What do you think is going on?
What do I think is really going on?